Were you bitten by a radioactive spider? Speaking of spiders, because you could be gaining superhuman hearing abilities. Can you like run much faster and leap higher than you could before as well? Can you see through walls?
Oh my goodness.
Imagine what a curse it would be to get superhuman hearing, but only for fan noise.
Only for I think I already have that.
Yeah, I was going to say that is John.
That's superhuman vision, but only for dead pixels.
I am having a slight problem with my iMac Pro.
Of course you are. Of course you are. Coincidentally, I actually have had a slight problem with my iMac Pro, which we'll talk about later. But Marco, tell me, what terrible tragedy has befallen your iMac Pro that's going to necessitate a replacement with a Mac Pro?
I wouldn't say necessitate, but it did kind of make me think,
Of course it did. Things that make you go,
I've started hearing the fan a lot more often. It started to spin up a lot more to audible levels. For the first, so I've had the computer for what, about 2 years now? For the first, 23 months of ownership, I never heard the fan spin up, not a single time. Recently, every time I do a big build in Xcode, it spins up very noticeably for a while.
Really?
So I'm assuming it's probably just full of dust. And I don't really know how to clean it out. I figure obviously besides taking it to an Apple service provider, which I don't want to do, is maybe if I take it down from my desk and blow compressed air through its exhaust vent. My theory is maybe if I blow canned air into the exhaust vent, it'll force all the dust and crap out the intake vents.
Maybe. You should take a look at the geometry of the inside of that thing before you...
Yeah, I should, yeah. Radarsky in the chat says it's full of sand
or spiders.
Well done.
Spiders.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
that's very good.
So I'm hoping this is easily solved with dust. But honestly, if this is just how this computer is now, I'm going to be very upset because one of the things I love most about this computer is I never hear it, and now I hear it frequently, and that's very, very annoying. But it's a very recent thing, so I'm assuming it's something I can hopefully fix.
Remember, I told you that. The Mac Pro is louder just at idle than an iMac at idle because the fans are not behind a solid thing, right?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't, and now the fact that audio never changes, and as far as I could tell, my fans literally never spin any faster than idle ever, doesn't change the fact that there is sort of a higher low level idle hum. So I'm not sure if a Mac Pro solves this problem for you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if they had updated the iMac Pro, I might have ordered it to fix this problem. Unfortunately, they haven't. Because, yeah, if for some reason this problem can't be fixed, if my iMac Pro is just getting flaky because it's 2 years old, which it sure shouldn't, but, it wouldn't be the first time that happened to an iMac, then I would honestly, if looking at the current lineup, I think I would still honestly just buy another iMac Pro. I would just feel bad buying two of the same generation. But this is probably something that's easily fixed, but I sure hope so.
The tough thing about it is you're still on Mojave on that, right?
Whoop in the chat says, this is the computing equivalent to my ashtray is full. New car time.
Well, I think you could file us under the category of, compressed air. Is there anything you can't fix?
Yeah, right.
Well, I hope. I mean, we'll see.
When it comes to Apple hardware, compressed air is the cure-all.
I'll follow it up next year. Do I have to hold my iMac Pro at a 75 degree angle?
That is a whole different tech note for what angle you have to hold the iMac Pro at.
Oh, goodness, I don't even want to think about it. The funny thing about this is, for a fleeting moment, I thought, could this be software? But you're still on Mojave, aren't you?
Yeah, I have not changed my software setup at all.
Well, but you never know with Apple these days, which is really unfortunate. In fact, somebody pointed out to me, or maybe I saw, I think it was a Insta story that MKBHD put up a day or two back, where he was exhibiting the janky and laggy mouse movement that I was seeing on my old iMac. And he was seeing this, if I recall correctly, on either the Mac Pro or a 16-inch MacBook Pro. And Was it a laptop? John, defend your honor there. So anyways, I saw that and was like, oh, yeah, I really need to hold off on the Catalina upgrade.
Yeah, but it was in a Slack because when I saw that video, I was like, I've never had this happen to me because I thought, I have had cursor jumping around, when I try to use the Bluetooth mouse with my wife's iMac, but it did not look like that. That was very smooth motion, but delayed by half a second from the input motion. And I've not experienced that. I've experienced it where you try to move it and it jumps from one place on the screen to another instead of moving in a smooth line. But That is very weird.
Yeah, and that is one of the things I saw when I also saw the machine gun trackpad. So, very weird. Well, Marco, I'm sorry to hear that your iMac Pro needs to be replaced with a Mac Pro. but I'm glad that this difficult time where you didn't have a justification for it is now over.
If there was either a new iMac Pro or an Apple 5K display, it would make this a lot more tempting.
Oh, I feel so bad for you in your time of woe. Well, I had some interesting iMac problems, which we'll talk about later. But we should start with some follow-up as per the rules. Marco, tell me about AirPods and in-flight entertainment systems, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so last episode, I basically said how much I love the AirPods Pro and how I really don't plan on bringing any other headphones on planes for the foreseeable future because they're so good and so much smaller than full-size noise-canceling headphones that the travel benefit of the small size and the performance of the noise-canceling is fantastic. And I still stand by that. They're great. But a few people wrote in to say, what if you want to listen to the in-flight entertainment system? That basically, like, one of the reasons why they still carry headphones that can be wired is that they like to plug in and, you know, watch movies on the little screens that are on the in-flight thing. And that's a perfectly valid opposing idea. I just never thought about it because I never do that. I always bring my own entertainment. Like, I bring either an iPad or a laptop or both, and I will watch videos on that if I want to watch something. It just never really came up for me, but that is a totally valid thing. Now, there are little Bluetooth transmitting dongles that you can get for like $20 or $30, plug into the headphone jack of the airplane, and they will broadcast a Bluetooth signal to a pair of Bluetooth headphones that you have. I have never used one, and I'm not sure whether the AirPods could pair to it or not, because I don't know how the pairing really works there. So that might be a solution, but I can't really speak for it. But certainly for non-AirPods Bluetooth headphones, those things are always fine. But most of those headphones also can be wired optionally, so you're better off just doing that.
If it were me, I think I would probably bring my AirPods or AirPods Pro and then bring one of my 84 old earpod, corded earpods.
Right.
With my first several iPhones. Like, that's not the most enjoyable way to watch anything on a plane. But if I am slumming it to the point that I'm watching the in-flight entertainment, then at that point, all bets are off. Because I'm like you, Marco, not only do I likely have a computer, but I certainly have an iPad that has certainly used Plex to sync a whole bunch of media that I thought I would enjoy on the flight. So yeah, this is not a problem that I find myself having, but it is an interesting point nonetheless.
Also, it's funny, like, we're at this point technologically where, you know, not only does whatever you want to bring with you on your laptop or iPad or whatever, not only do you probably have better stuff that you enjoy better, and you probably have a bigger selection available if you've prepared at all, but also the screen is likely to be not only larger, but also better quality. Like, indeed, those screens and airplane seats are so bad. They must be like TN panels. Like, they have terrible viewing angles and terrible contrast, and they just look terrible, and they're so unresponsive. And yes, I know I'm supposed to listen to the in-flight announcements, but rarely are those correctly volume leveled to the content that plays back on the in-flight entertainment system. So usually what happens is if you turn the volume up enough to hear speech in the movie you're watching, then if there's a pilot announcement, it like blows your ears out. It's so loud.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, you know, it's very hard to use that and have a good experience. So it's much better to bring your own stuff. As long as you prepared and you have any device, any modern device that has a screen, I'd rather even watch a movie on my phone than watch it on the in-flight entertainment system. Like, that's how much the quality difference matters to me.
Yep, I completely agree with you there.
The only thing that the in-flight entertainment screens are for is, in my opinion, is either to be off if it's a dark flight, or if it's a light flight, to show the map.
Yep. You and I are of the same mind, my friend. Completely agree.
And by the way, this is a small thing. Two little notes that I have. My recent flight, we flew on JetBlue. First time I've flown on JetBlue in a while, because they don't usually go where I want to go. Anyway, all of JetBlue seems like a series of ads now. It's one of those many, I think, American airlines that now during the flight, the in-flight crew comes on and makes long announcements that are credit card offers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yep.
This seems like it's crossing a line, you know? So not only are the people speaking credit card offers to you using the same announcement system that they speak important flight information and critical instructions, but then also then they walk down the aisle holding up this like brochure and offering, mm-hmm. it's like, and you can tell the flight attendants don't want to do this. Like, you know, you can see it in their eyes. Like, they're doing this because they have to. They don't want to do it. That's not their job. It shouldn't be their job, but their job is making them do it, right? And so that's ads. And then on the in-flight screen, I just want to watch the map screen. If it's going to be on, just show me the map screen. But nope, it cycles through. It's showing the map screen maybe 10 seconds out of every minute. And the rest of the time it's cycling through like billboard ads on the screen.
It's so bad.
No wonder we bring our own screens now. Like the in-flight screens have gotten so bad.
Yeah, well, the screens, to your point a few minutes ago, the screen quality was never good, even when they were brand new.
Yeah.
But yeah, the content is also terrible these days. A friend of the show, Jelly, just sent me, you know, it's basically in-flight push notifications, which I think is completely accurate. So well done, Jeff.
Remember when, I think it was Virgin America, that they actually had like seat-to-seat messaging, and
their remotes
had a little keyboard on the back, and this was like right before everybody had their own smartphones and everything in their pockets anyway all the time, and right before everybody had Wi-Fi everywhere and everything, and it was just like, it was like the coolest thing in the world for like a year when Virgin America first came out, and you could message someone else in, like, you know, like if you were sitting separately from some other member of your family or party, you could like message, oh, send this message to seat 16C. The weirdest idea.
It is a weird idea, but it was very interesting. You know, I have to point out, I don't remember what airline it was, and honestly, it doesn't matter, but on a couple of the flights I've flown in the last year, there's been some deal, I think via T-Mobile, but it doesn't really matter. Some way, somehow, you could send iMessages for free, even if you didn't pay for in-flight Wi-Fi, which I thought was extremely cool. That was very, very nice. And it just reminded me again that Aaron's entire side of the family is on Android, which kind of stinks. But for those of us who are on iMessage, that was really, really convenient and really nice. And I thought that was a very nice middle of the road between screw you, give us $15 to $25 to $35 for in-flight Wi-Fi, and, you know, oh yeah, everything's free. Whee! You know, I thought it was a very good middle of the road.
Also, to complete travel tips corner here, this is one thing that, like, as SSL has become more and more universal on websites, it has actually become somewhat harder to find a site that is never SSL, so that if you're in a captive portal Wi-Fi thing, like on many planes, I had to actually do this, because, like, normally, the Apple Wi-Fi thing should detect when you're in a captive portal, and it should put a little slide-up thing up that lets you log in or click the accept button or whatever you have to do. Sometimes that just doesn't work for whatever reason. Whatever, like, Apple's test page, it doesn't detect that it's a captive portal or whatever. And so you have to, you know, go type in, like, you know, google.com or whatever, and then you know it'll capture that and redirect you to their login page so you can log into the Wi-Fi. Well, you can't do that anymore with SSL everywhere, and most browsers won't even attempt to go to, like, google.com because it'll use HSTS or something. And so, like, there's actually a site, neverssl.com, that is never served over SSL. So if you're on a captive portal and you need a site that you know will redirect you to the login page, go to neverssl.com. Isn't that cool?
That's very good.
Or you can go to alwayshttp.com if you prefer the reverse logic.
Yeah, glass half full, half empty, yeah.
Oh, that's very good. All right. Henrik Helmers had a very good point. This was with regard to our conversation last episode about how Marco and I don't really feel like there's any point to our big cameras anymore. That's a summary. You get the idea.
Oh, God. Please don't email us based on that summary.
Please don't email us.
that's a dramatically very simplified summary.
Yes. But anyway, the point being, Henrik pointed out, and they're spot on, the ergonomics of the iPhone as a camera is very poor. I would argue the iPhone has worse ergonomics than any physical camera currently for sale. I don't know if I want to take that bet or not, but certainly the broad point is absolutely true, that the ergonomics of trying to physically operate the iPhone as a camera is not great. But I stand by what Marco and I were saying, that for 80 to 95% of my use cases anyway, it's the best camera I have these days.
I think that's an area for possible improvement. I mean, we know that the battery case has the camera activation button to launch the camera app, which is a step in the right direction. Because when you need to quickly take out your phone and use it as a camera, it's a tricky skill. It's a tricky thing to become good at. It's a small object that's pretty uniform and smooth around all the edges. You may have to tap something on the screen if you don't want to use like the volume button, shutter, or whatever, but depending on how you have it oriented, you might not know where all that stuff is going to be. by adding affordances for quickly being able to launch the camera app and use it to take a photo, that makes the phone a more valuable, more useful camera. And I think you can do some of that without making like the phone, making it phone, the phone camera shaped. Like the, if you just, I mean, we've talked about a dedicated camera button for years, but you know, not just the one that launches the thing, but a dedicated shutter button other than using volume and maybe multiple buttons. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of a newly shaped phone or a newly shaped phone case, maybe, that reflects the reality of our phones. It's kind of like, you know, Mike Hurley and many other people in their pop sockets. Like, the reason that's so popular is it's better ergonomics for using the phone in a particular way. Not for pictures in that case, but just, you know, for very large phones being held in one hand safely and securely, right? It's not something you couldn't do before, but people are willing to buy basically a little outfit for their phone and dress it up for its new role as, you know, hey, iPhone Pro Max, you're giant, but I can hold you with one hand now because I've got a pop socket. I can imagine like something like a smart connector or other kind of sort of smooth contacts on the naked robotic core that is the iPhone that allow you to put on basically a camera case that has more grips and shutter buttons in various places so that you could take out your phone blindfolded, point it in a direction, and take a photo. It's, you can do that today, but it takes a little bit more fumbling. I feel like I could take out my big camera and point it in a direction, take a photo easier with blindfolded than I could with a phone, and certainly more securely, like in, if I was timed and said, get it out quick, and point in the right direction, and do it all blindfolded. My camera is camera-shaped. It's very easy to see where all the buttons are. I don't need to look at them. It is not symmetrical in any way. It's very clear where the gigantic lens is pointed and where the shutter button is and whether it's on or off and all that other stuff. Not true at all of a phone. You'd have to take it out and feel around with it to find where the camera is, make sure it's facing the right direction, make sure you know is the camera in the upper left, upper right, lower left, or lower right corner, because sometimes that matters when you're taking a picture. So I look forward to, I haven't been keeping track of the rumors, but I look forward to a future iPhone, maybe not this new redesign, but maybe the one after, that has the ability to be more camera shaped.
One can dream. All right, let's talk about Scott Simpson and jumpy mice. John, can you tell me about this?
Yeah, we're going to talk more about mice later. But remember when I first got my Mac Pro, I was saying how I'd hooked up the little Logitech dongle RF receiver thingy. And when I put it in the back of my computer, it was getting terrible signal. My cursor was jumping all over. So I used that little Apple USB-C to USB-A adapter, which is like 3 or 4 inches long, and put the little RF dongle in that. And it worked. And I was doing it, I was putting it on the top ports. Like instead of being around the back, I was putting it on the top. In retrospect, I should have realized that like the 1.5 foot distance between the back of the computer and the top of the computer surely is not accounting, you know, that doesn't explain the incredible difference in signal quality that I was getting. So here's the actual explanation, and I find this depressing and somewhat infuriating. This is an Intel paper. Intel, the company largely responsible for USB. It's on their website. I don't know if the people did it, but anyway, it's a study showing that the noise generated by USB 3.0 data can have an impact on radio receivers whose antennas are placed close to a USB 3.0 device and or USB 3.0 connector. We will put the link in the show notes. It's a PDF. We apologize for the PDF. But it is straightforward. Like they do a bunch of tests and say, here, if you put something near a USB 3 port that has data going through it, the act of the data going through that port will cause interference with things on a similar spectrum. So that explains why my little Logitech turd thingy wasn't working on the back of my computer, because guess what? It's right next to a USB 3 port that was connected to like my external SSD, you know? And similarly, I have other USB 3 devices in an external hub or whatever. That's bad. Like if you're coming up with a standard, make sure that it doesn't cause radio interference with other things. And it's not just the devices, the ports themselves, if they're not well shielded or not ridiculously well shielded. Even the devices, the experiment where they were like wrapping the external SSD in tin foil or some kind of foil to try to keep the noise, the USB 3.0 generated noise from coming out of that. I feel like this is the type of thing you should figure out before you release the standard to the world. If you have, and it's 3.0 only, it's not apparently not 2.0. So here I am with a bunch of USB 3.0 devices coming out of the back of my computer. And that's why it was different when it was on the top, because the signal, the interference decreases rapidly as you move away from the port or the device. So being on top of the computer, it wasn't like it was closer to the mouse. It was farther from the USB 3.0 port that had a lot of data going through it. So if you're wondering why you get bad signal for your little RF receiver for your Logitech mouse, or you're getting other weird behavior and you have a bunch of USB 3.0 peripherals and or cables, read this paper and see if any of the solutions they recommend help you. I just like knowing what's going on, but boy, this is. I hope USB 4 doesn't have similar problems.
I'm sure it'll have even better and newer problems for us to contend with.
It'll have problems without a space. USB 4, no space.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about photo sharing. A little bit more follow-up there. Mario Panagetti says, you can send iCloud photo links to people with non-Apple devices. Instead of adding the photos to the library, they'll just get a zip download of all the photos. And my testing Android phones don't always know what to do with this. Surprise, surprise. Andrew Elliott writes, also it creates a public web page viewable by any browser, which expires within 30 days. And finally, Jared Counts writes, I recently sent some photos to my wife via iCloud/iMessage. If she opened the link on her phone, she could import directly into photos, but opening the link on her Mac showed a page with a download button for a zip file, as Mario had mentioned. So all a little bit more feedback on photo sharing, which was an Ask ATP a couple of weeks ago. John, this is something about Destiny, don't care. Let's talk about rack mount Mac Pros.
It's not about Destiny. It's about a PS4 controller.
Still don't care.
You do care. Someday do you're going to care. Someday one of your children is going to complain that they want to use their PS4 controller to play Minecraft on one of your Macs, and you'll be like, oh, you'll be glad you heard about this. me saying that, like, I had my PS4 controller, which was working fine in Windows 10, with Steam and everything. It was paired. It was working. It could navigate the interface. But as soon as I launched the game couldn't see it because the game itself had its own notions about connecting to the PS4 controller, and I had to plug it in. Well, apparently there is a wireless adapter that very kind of like the RF adapter for Logitech mice that makes your computer think that it has a wired PS4 controller plugged into it. And really, it's got a little transmitter receiver pair that make that happen. And apparently, if you buy the one from Japan, it's cheaper. So we'll put a link in the show notes if you'd like to use your PS4 controller wirelessly with your quote-unquote PC or Mac in boot camp in a game that insists that it must be a wired connection. This will fake it out.
You know, I will say, as much as I'm giving you junk about this, I was trying to use, I don't remember the name of the emulator, but I was trying to use a Mac-based emulator to emulate software that I had acquired a while ago and that strongly resembled software I used and played as a kid. And anyways, I tried to hook up my Nintendo Switch controller via Bluetooth to my old iMac, was the last time I tried this. And it was a pain in the hindquarters trying to get that to work. And even when it did, like, it was still a little bit wonky. So I thought about buying, like, one of the blessed controllers that Apple supports. I think there's at least a couple, but maybe this would be another solution to my problem.
The PS4 controllers will just pair directly to your Mac, I think, with no anything. Like, I know what you're talking about, like the made for iPhone, whatever they are, the ones that work with iOS devices.
Right.
But with the Mac, I think both PS4 and Xbox controllers will just pair. Just you go and you put them into pairing mode, go into Bluetooth, you connect, and that's it.
I think you're right. I think the problem was I was doing it with the Switch Pro controller, and that's where I fell in my face.
I think that's not one of the ones that's on the list of things that just get supported out of the box on Macs.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host. Whether you are working on a personal project or managing your enterprise's infrastructure, if you need servers, Linode has the pricing, support, and scale you need to take your project to the next level. They have 11 data centers worldwide right now, and they're always adding more. This includes their newest data center in Sydney, Australia. all these data centers have enterprise-grade hardware. They now have an S3-compatible storage option. All this is backed by their next-generation network. So Linode delivers the performance and features you expect at a price that you honestly don't expect. I've been using Linode myself for almost a decade now. I just can never believe how great of a value they've been the entire time I've been with them. Long before they were a sponsor of the show, I've been using my servers all there at Linode because, frankly, it's my favorite place to have servers. I've used a lot of web hosts over the years. It starts out small. You know, you can get a plan for just $5 a month with 1 gig of RAM. And then everything above that, any needs you might have above that, they have something to suit your needs. It's really incredible. They have a new revamped cloud manager, and it's built on an open source single page app. They have a full API that the cloud manager uses, so you can whatever you can do in the cloud manager, you can also do in the API. So you can script things if you need to. All sorts of specialties like dedicated CPU plans, GPU compute plans, everything like that. They have everything you need. Their support is great whenever you need it, and they're also hiring. Go to linode.com/careers if that's up your alley there. So check out today, linode.com/ATP. By far my favorite web host. Get a $20 credit with promo code ATP2020. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all my stuff and sponsoring our show.
Tell me about Rack Mount Mac Pros, if you don't mind.
They're available. The slow rollout of the Mac Pro continues. It's not complete, but this is the next step. The Rack Mount Mac Pro that has been on the page for a long time, but you could never actually click the configure button. Now you can click configure, and really the options look basically the same, except that it starts at $6,500 instead of starting at $6,000. You can look at a gallery, which has a grand total of 3 pictures. It shows the front, which has a bunch of holes and 2 smaller handles for pulling out the rack. It shows the side, which looks to, or, you know, the cutaway, which looks like it's basically the same motherboard with the same components in the same places, with a couple of extra things thrown on the front. I'm not quite sure what they are. I hope iFixit gets one of these and tears it down, but I can't even, maybe it's just dead space in front of it. I don't know. And then finally, it shows the back, which is a little bit weird. I mean, first you can see how much wider it is than the regular one. But second, the back does not have the same scalloped cheese grater hole pattern. Instead, it just looks like it has a much more sort of, you know, previous generation cheese grater pattern. It's just a flat piece of metal with a bunch of holes punched in it, a bunch of very tiny holes punched in it. So if you want to pay $500 for a bigger Mac Pro that can fit in a rack, now you finally can.
I have a very important question. Does this count as the 2020 Mac Pro?
I mean, maybe. I wonder, I guess if you buy it, it probably does, they probably do consider it the 2019 Mac Pro rack. Like, what is the name of this product even? Let me see what it says on the page. It just says Mac Pro. Like, surely there is some way to differentiate it in Apple's official literature. Say, what kind of Mac do you have? You don't just say you have a Mac Pro, because if you come with this thing,
it's probably just like you know, they don't give the wheel configuration its own product name. Like, this is, it's probably considered still the Mac Pro, just it happens to be in a radically different case.
Tell me about Pro Display XDR True Tone, if you don't mind.
One thing I forgot to talk about when talking about my Pro Display XDR is that it comes with True Tone. I'm so out of the loop on other options. Does the iMac Pro or any of the iMacs have a True Tone option? No?
I have Night Shift. That doesn't count.
Yeah. So I think for True Tone, obviously you need the sensors.
Yeah.
And maybe there's just those don't exist. I mean, I guess you could use the camera. I don't even know. Anyway, the XDR has True Tone. And so playing with the monitor when I first got it is one of the things I considered. And, you know, what's your, both of your positions on True Tone on all your devices that supported, mostly iOS devices?
I use it.
I use it wherever it's supported. I find it quite subtle, and I've never really noticed it. I used to use the other one, Night Shift. I used to use Night Shift a little bit more. I think it's now disabled on my stuff. But yeah, Night Shift used to be a much bigger effect. But yeah, True Tone, I don't really notice it. So I just leave it on.
Yeah, so I on my iOS devices, I use True Tone all the time. It's kind of one of those things, like when it first came out, I was like, do I really want something trying to mess with the colors based on what it thinks about the environmental colors? Isn't that going to look weird sometimes? Wouldn't I rather just have the screen just do accurate colors all the time, regardless of my ambient light? But I don't know. I guess I just went with it, figuring that if I enable it and I don't notice any difference, that it means that like the light hitting my eyes in contrast to the surrounding light, you know, should it, I'm not optimizing for the accuracy of what is emitted. I'm optimizing for the accuracy of what gets to my eyeballs, which includes some reflected light. And I don't know. So anyway, I leave it on and I'm fine with it. But on this thing, I'm like, well, I'm going to be editing photos on here. Do I want this thing messing with the photos? So I've tried it on and off, and it's the type of thing where if you turn it on, you very quickly stop noticing that it's on. But as soon as you turn it off, you're like, wow, that's a big color difference. And usually it's shifting it more blue, right? So you turn it off and it looks bluer mm-hmm. than normal. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like I think I'm going to end up leaving it on, but it's definitely like a different vibe. Like if I... you know, the thing is, it has a nice fade effect too. It doesn't just switch immediately. Like I just turned it off and I was like, everything is blue.
Yeah. Yep.
And when I turn it on, like for a second, things start to look a little yellow, but then everything acclimates. And I don't know. It's a little bit of a conflict in my life here. I think I'm probably just going to leave it on, edit all my photos with it on. I think if like on a sunny day with all the windows open or the blinds open, that it'll basically be the same. But at night with this weird artificial lighting, I don't know. And the second thing is there's two different presets that come with this, like in the color profiles below. One says Pro Display XDR and then in parentheses P3-1600 nits. And the second one says Apple Display P3-500 nits. And I've tried each one of those things, and other than, I assume, the top preset being able to go to the maximum 1600 nits when you play the HDR content and the bottom one not, I can't tell what the heck they're doing. So I'm just leaving it on the default. It came out of the box set to P3 1600 nits, and I'm just leaving it on that.
I have no thoughts about this whatsoever.
Yeah, this is the thing about HDR. I mean, this is my first HDR experience. I know technically like the iPhones have HDR, yada, yada, but like this is my first display that has HDR that you can really notice, especially in Windows, which handles this terribly. When I try to play Destiny in HDR and then like get the game to switch back to the quote unquote desktop in Windows, when it goes into HDR mode, like the entire like non-HDR content, like just your icons and windows or whatever, looks like washed out and gross. Like it changes the colors of that to support HDR. And so you can sort of catch a glimpse of what the rest of the world would look like in HDR mode. But when you leave the game, it switches out of HDR mode in Windows and goes back to like regular display so that, you know, white stuff looks white again instead of everything looking like a gray haze over it. The Mac handles it much more gracefully. So when I play HDR video, I can tell that the brightest whites in that HDR video are so much brighter than any other white that's been on the screen before that. You can narrow the gap by cranking the brightness up to max, but you do not want to do that. I mean, I think we all know on these modern displays, on modern desktop displays, putting the brightness at max will burn your eyeballs out. Don't do that, right?
Yeah.
But the HDR, like, I don't think there's a way to get it to display like an all white text edit window at 1600 nits, unless you put that in a movie. Right. Cause I think the display will never, you know, it's not high. The Mac desktop experience is not high dynamic range. As far as I'm able to tell, only video is that. And that means only video is going to reach those peaks of 1600 nits. At least that's my understanding. And if somebody who actually knows stuff about reference monitors and HDR displays and macOS specifically has any guidance or something I can read or answers, please write into the show and let us know.
All right. So things seem to be mostly good with your new Mac Pro, but I see the following in the show notes. Quote, Mac Pro Ethernet wonkiness, quote, and coincidentally, I have iMac Pro Ethernet wonkiness that I'd like to discuss after you're done. But tell me, is there trouble in paradise, John?
So my Ethernet wonkiness is it's a quick one, but it's a thing that the other five people listening to this show who have Mac Pros may run across. So my Mac Pro, like most of my desktop Macs, I just turn off Wi-Fi because I want wired connections for everything. I don't want them bothering sending their signal, transmit and receive signal out into the air. Just get off Wi-Fi. Don't need it. Don't want it.
You don't use AirDrop then?
Or Apple Watch Unlock?
No. I mean, you know, I'm not using Apple Watch on the lock. I don't wear a watch, right? And AirDrop, no, I don't use AirDrop. I don't hand off. I don't want the little icon sliding up next to my dock. I don't want any of that.
I'm assuming that your previous Mac Pro was not AirDrop compatible.
my previous Mac Pro did not have Wi-Fi.
Right. I would suggest turning it on for AirDrop, because if you do the little network preferences priority list and just put the Ethernet first, all your networking stuff will still go over Ethernet, but leave the Wi-Fi on for AirDrop.
Yep.
What do you think I'm AirDropping?
Anything. Photos? Anything.
Yeah, sometimes I'll send a photo from my phone to my Mac if I want it, like, immediately there, like, without waiting for sync. Sometimes Tiff or I will AirDrop things to each other's computers. If the network isn't working right, or if it's just fast, or if it's from iOS to the computer. Yeah, there's lots of times where I use it.
No, I don't think I have occasion to transfer anything from my iOS devices to my Mac that's not, like, already there through some sync process. But I'll keep it in mind if it ever comes up. I certainly have the capability now, unlike my previous computer. But anyway, I connect the Ethernet. The Mac Pro has two 10 gigabit Ethernet ports. I personally, in my house, have an 8-port switch that's the same 8-port switch that I've been using with my 2008 Mac Pro. It's not as old as my 2008 Mac Pro, because I think I replaced it at some point in its lifetime. But it's not a new switch. It's old enough that I can't get a replacement that looks like it, because I needed a bunch of switches. I think when I got the Synology, that wasn't that long ago, right? But
it wasn't that long ago. That was almost 7 years.
Well, my Mac Pro was 3 years. My Mac Pro was 3 years old then. When I got that, I said, "Oh, I want to get some switches. I'll get the same one that I've been using with my Mac here." And I couldn't find it because they changed the models around or whatever. So anyway, it's a pretty old switch, is what I'm getting at. You know, but it's a gigabit Ethernet switch, and it's a dumb switch. It's what could have changed since then? Well, something about this switch and the existence of 10 gig Ethernet do not get along with each other. I mean, it makes sense, because when I bought the switch, 10 gig Ethernet did not exist as a standard over copper, as far as I'm aware. So it kind of makes sense that this switch wouldn't expect that. Anyway, when I connected everything up on my Mac, one of the things I did was a speed test to make sure that I had everything working the way I wanted, and my internet speeds were terrible, so incredibly slow and so incredibly close to 100 megabits that it immediately became clear to me that my interface was probably set to 100 megabits. And sure enough, I went into the Ethernet hardware settings, and it was like hardware speed, and it had selected 100 megabits, which is the wrong choice. And so basically what it comes down to is, in the negotiation between my Ethernet switch and my Mac, they could not see eye to eye. And I think my Ethernet switch said, "Fine, I'm just defaulting to my slow speed." So I went to 100 megabits. So I just manually set it to gigabit, and problem solved. But if you also have a semi-old Ethernet switch connected to your 10 gig Ethernet, be aware that they may not be friendly with each other, and you may have to do what I did, which is just manually set it to gigabit, and then lo and behold, hundreds of megabits a second up and down to the internet. Problem solved.
So let me tell you my tale of woe, because I've had a stressful 24 hours. And let me give you the extremely short version that Marco can drop in if he ends up cutting all this. I thought that my iMac Pro's Ethernet port was broken. Then I thought the Eero was broken. And it turns out that possibly, seemingly because of my Mocha bridge, everything was falling down on its face. But as soon as I disconnected the Mocha bridge from my switch, everything came back up and everything was fine. So the longer version of the story, and this is where Marco will do the fast forward sound effect. But the longer version of the story is that I noticed that my iMac Pro wasn't connected via Ethernet, and I thought that was very odd. And I started trying to troubleshoot, and I thought that, okay, this is weird, because the iMac just is refusing to pull an IP. It's seeing that thing that everything is connected physically, but it won't pull an IP. And I restart my Eero. I restart the switch, which, like you, John, is a gigabit switch I've had for probably 5 years or something like that. Nothing seems to be making a difference. Well, then I eventually think, all right, well, screw it. Thankfully, my Eero base station, the parent, if you will, Eero base station, is right there. And so I plug my iMac directly into the Eero. And that works, no problem. It immediately pulls an IP address. Everybody's happy. So I decide that the switch is broken. So because it's old, you know, even though there's no real intelligence there, you never know. So I decide to Amazon Prime now myself a new Switch, which, by the way, the fact that you can do that and within a couple hours it shows up still blows my mind, even though this is like a 5-year-old thing. But be that as it may. So I eventually get this new Switch in. I plug everything up and I'm ready to go. I'm excited. That must have been the, oh, no, it's not the problem.
Aw.
Okay. And I don't recall the exact timeline. At some point in this struggle, I decide to do a diagnostics on the iMac, and the iMac says, no, 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 everything's great. But I don't really trust that because my last iMac said, no, 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 everything's great when it wasn't. So I'm starting to get really upset at this point. And then I guess it was around now that I realized, okay, the Switch can't be the problem because it's brand new. And that's when I plugged into the Eero, and I feel like, okay, it's something about the combination of the Switch and the Eero. So I start blowing up Eero support via email saying, without actually saying, I would like a new one yesterday, please, because obviously this thing is jacked up. And they didn't put me through the entirety, I don't think, of their is it turned on kind of tech support rigmarole. But what they eventually said was, which I didn't think of myself, and I'm a little disappointed that I didn't think of it, but they eventually said, unplug everything from the Switch except your iMac and try that. And sure enough, that's when everything worked. And if this by some miracle actually makes it in the show, I would love to know from someone who knows more about this than me, why would the Mocha Bridge cause everything to fall down? So if you're not familiar with what that is, it's an acronym, something over coaxial, I think, media over coaxial or something like that. I don't know. But anyways, I still have TV service through Verizon Fios, and the way that our set-top box gets the TV guide, or whatever you want to call it, is through the internet. But the only way the set-top box is connected to the internet is via coax, the same cable that the video comes through. And in the past, this was fine because my Verizon-issued router also got its internet via coax, once I got gigabit, it had a coax port on it. So even though the internet was coming in via Ethernet in the newer router, it still would connect to coax so it could give the set-top box or boxes access to the internet. Well, what I did was, because I didn't want to use the Fios router anymore, and I really like Eero, which is a past sponsor and probably future sponsor, but I really like them. I decided I wanted to use my Eero, and so I got this thing called a Mocha Bridge, which is basically you plug coax into it, you plug Ethernet into it, and it, guess what, bridges the two networks. And I don't know what it is about this Mocha Bridge that caused everything to fall on its face, but since I have unplugged it, everything's been working great, except, of course, the set-top box. But if you know more about this stuff than I do, I would love to know how that could be a thing, other than maybe the bridge just needed to be like restarted or something. But I don't understand how that Mocha Bridge could have taken down my whole darn network. So if you know, and if this actually made it in the show, I would love to know. So please do let me know.
I never trusted those Mocha Bridge things. I don't like the idea of Ethernet over coax along with video signal. Just always seemed janky. That's why I've always wanted just like a box that's on the wall of my house, and what should come out of is an Ethernet cable and nothing else.
Yeah, which is what I have now. And I do, when everything works, I actually do like the Mocha Bridge. I have a fairly old one, and I don't recall what generation it is. But my understanding, having briefly looked into it, is that you can actually get gigabit or near gigabit speeds over more modern Mocha Bridges. And that's really important for someone like me who is too lazy to run Cat 6 throughout the house, but really would like to have an Ethernet drop across the house. Now, in my actual circumstance, I only use the Mocha Bridge for the purpose of the set-top box. But if I wanted to go, like my office is in the upper right corner of the house, if you will, and the family room is like below it and halfway back, and the kitchen is below it and on the opposite side of the house. So if I wanted for some reason an Ethernet drop in, say, the kitchen, I could use Mocha Bridges to get that Ethernet drop. I already have one that usually is plugged in up here in the office, and I could put a second one down in the kitchen, and then I have an Ethernet drop right there. And so in that sense, it's super convenient because I just ride on the stuff that's already in the walls. But yeah, something has gone very, very wrong with this, and I don't understand what, and it's kind of driving me crazy. I don't know. So thank you for indulging me, and we'll see if this actually makes it in the show. John, tell me about your sleep-wake battles, if you don't mind, please.
This is another thing about, I don't know, all new computers, most new computers in my life. That's one thing I appreciated about my 2008 Mac Pro, and a thing that I hate about most laptops, sleeping and waking. my Mac Pro, my previous Mac Pro, you know, it had energy saver settings where you could say, do you want it to wake for network access? And you could do scheduled wakes and sleeps. I think those are basically the only options. And you could also say when the screen goes to sleep and how long at idle before the computer goes to sleep. And all those settings worked all the time. I know that doesn't sound like much, but anyone who has a laptop or another Mac that they have these issues with knows that's not, you know, you don't take that for granted. Like the settings I had on my old Mac Pro were never sleep by yourself except for during the schedule. The schedule was wake up at like 3 a.m. and then I had Backblaze scheduled to run then and then go to sleep like an hour and a half or 2 hours later, right? So if you just left my Mac awake all the time, it would eventually cross 3 a.m. and do its thing, and then it would hit its scheduled sleep and it would go to sleep, right? But otherwise, it would never automatically go to sleep. So that's so I could have like long-running downloads or other sorts of things. And in theory, all those sort of long-running operations should already keep the computer awake, but sometimes they didn't, especially in the old days. So it was just nice to be able to have a computer that I knew would act in a predictable way. And when I put it to sleep, which I did, you know, frequently, I never shut it down, but I wouldn't just leave it running all day because it's a big thing that uses a lot of power. I'd put it to sleep when I'm not using it, and it would just immediately go to sleep, and it wouldn't wake up until either that 3 a.m. wake-up time came or until I came back and woke it up. Again, not necessarily true of laptops. So this new computer has more settings than the old one did. It has all sorts of other things that will wake it up. Some of them are sort of revealed in the UI. Like it's got Power Nap, which I think my other thing didn't have, that lets it like wake up silently and check for email and do Time Machine backups or whatever. I don't know how silently it does those wake ups. And you know, it's got startup after power failure. I think my old one had that. And then it's got wake for network access and, you know, the hard disk sleep option, all that other, all the good stuff. But with this computer, I was having a bunch of issues where I'd put the computer to sleep when I walked away from it, just, you know, my old habits from my old Mac. And I'd come back in the room a little bit later, and I'd eventually realize that the computer is awake. The screen is still black, but the computer is awake. And this led me to a couple of realizations. One, despite what I said before about the fan noise, every time I would come in here, I would be like, is my computer awake? I put it to sleep. Is it awake? And I couldn't tell unless I walked up to it and put my ear like right in front of the grating on the front of the computer.
It's like somebody who sleeps with their eyes open. Like, are they asleep?
Yeah, like, are they alive? Are they breathing?
Put your finger under their nose to see if they're breathing.
Yeah, and this is like what I was saying before. It's like, well, when the computer's on and it's idle and I'm sitting in the chair here, you know, 3 feet away from it, like, I can still hear it. But when I'm doing the sleep-wake testing, sometimes I'd be sitting in the chair, like I'd be on like my work laptop in the same exact chair, but I'd put the big, you know, the Mac Pro to sleep, but I'd just be on the laptop. And then I'd like, did the Mac Pro just wake up? And I wouldn't be able to tell for sure unless I got up out of my chair, went over to the computer and put my ear to it. The same chair that I'm sitting in right now. So despite me saying that at idle you can hear the fans, apparently you can't hear them well enough for me to determine with certainty whether the thing just woke up or not, right? So they're really quiet. Now, like I said, I think if you made me bet, like, all right, I'm not letting you get up from the chair, but place your bet. Do you think it's awake or asleep? I think I can mostly tell. I think I'd have maybe 90% success rate, but it's borderline. So that's one point of that. The second point is, why the hell is my computer waking up, right? Anyone who has dealt with this before with a laptop or otherwise hopefully knows all the many things that can wake your computer up. I'll link to a good article by Howard Oakley in the Eclectic Light Company, which is a great website for Mac nerdery. But this is one of those topics where if you Google for why is my Mac waking up, and especially if you know something about how to debug it and you start Googling for the words that involve debugging it, you will find so many results across like decades, right? This is a common problem. The solutions vary. The tools for looking into the solutions vary a little bit more lately. The pmset command line tool is your friend. I think, you know, pmset minus g log, giving you a log of the sleeping and waking, and pmset minus g assertions to see You know, if your problem is that your Mac won't go to sleep, even though you tell it to go to sleep after 5 minutes of an activity, you can see who's keeping it awake and why. Every time your computer wakes up, those logs will say awake reason. Why did I wake up? And the wake reasons will say very obscure text that you will then type into Google and find a million people whose computer are waking up with the exact same thing. If you have a more recent Mac or a more recent OS, you'll see that the wake reasons have information redacted for privacy reasons, which is a new innovation to try to keep like private information out of the logs, but it is not particularly helpful when you're trying to figure out why your computer is waking up. Why might your computer be waking up? Well, there's wake on network access, but you can just uncheck that checkbox and you've got that solved. And by the way, I never have that checked just because if you have any, especially for any computer that there is any route to that computer from the internet, like say you're running like a Plex server on something and you want it to be accessible from the internet, there is a way from the internet to get to that computer. If that is the case, and you have wake on network access available, you put it to sleep, it will wake from network access in 3 seconds because things are port scanning the internet like 24/7, right? It is a hostile environment. If you wake on network access, somehow, some way, that wake-up packet will go flying through. I don't understand how it can do that because I wrote a little program to send the wake-up packet, and I think it has to be sort of like handcrafted, and I didn't think you could get to it from the internet, but anyway, maybe it's my hostile environment in my house. My experience has shown if you do wake for network access, your computer will never sleep for long. It'll be like a parent of a baby, right? It's an infant. Like you'll put it to sleep and it will be woken up. So I suggest if you want your computer to stay asleep, not enabling that. Bluetooth devices. Bluetooth devices love to wake up a computer. Why? Beats the hell out of me. That's one of the reasons I have Bluetooth turned off on my computer most of the time. Bluetooth, like, are they just lonely? Are they glitching? Did someone nudge a mouse? Is there some kind of vibration? But, you know, if you're trying to debug this thing of like, is a Bluetooth device waking up my computer? Turn off Bluetooth. Then at least you eliminate that problem, hopefully, by turning off Bluetooth. USB devices of all kinds love to wake up your computer. Again, why? Why are they waking up your computer? I don't know. Static electricity? Again, somebody nudges them?
Solar flares?
Yeah, bugs in the firmware, like external hard drives that USB hard drives that the thing tries to spin down when they're idle, but then like wake themselves back up. Like if you know, and you'll see like wake reason, HID, USB, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, what does that mean? What is waking up my computer? Why won't you stay asleep? Again, much like infants. Why won't you sleep? Why won't you sleep for more than 30 minutes? You're killing me. So anyway, I went through that procedure with this computer over the course of the first week I had it. I did eventually get to the point where I am now, where when I put it to sleep, it stays asleep until the scheduled wake-up time. But it did take going through all this stuff, removing. I had a USB hard drive that was always connected, and I said, you're not going to be always connected. I'm only going to connect you when I need to boot from boot camp, and otherwise you're going to sit on a shelf. Turned off Bluetooth, disabled for network access, found a bunch of other programs that were putting in assertions that were keeping it from idle sleeping. And so I think I'm mostly okay. There's this other thing, by the way, called dark wake, which is where I think it's where it wakes up but doesn't turn the screen on. I think that's this affiliated with PowerNap. Sometimes you'll see a dark wake. Anyway, pmset minus g log will show you the sleep wakes, and I was graphing them. There is another stuff like the real-time clock, what is it, mdns resolver, whatever that thing is, the thing that was Discovery D, we got changed back. That wakes your computer every 2 hours to do some real-time clock maintenance, something, yada, yada. Like, but anyway, since you have a log of these events, you can graph them and see when is my computer waking up and when is it going to sleep. And it has been improving to the point where I feel like it's an understandable, predictable cadence. It will sort of wake up without turning the screen on and do some kind of maintenance thing that I'm pretty sure I can't stop it from doing. I don't understand what real-time clock maintenance means other than perhaps, I don't know, synchronizing the real-time clock with an NTP server. I don't know what the hell it's doing, but occasionally it wakes itself up every 2 hours briefly and does a thing and goes back to sleep. But as long as it mostly stays asleep, I'm happy with it. So I don't know if this is going to help anybody, except to let you know that if you are having problems with your computer waking up when you don't want it, or problems with it going to sleep when you command it to, or letting it go to sleep from idle, there's a world of pain out there, but it is possible to defeat it with a little bit of effort and process of elimination. Kind of like Casey with unplugging everything and turning everything off with his various routers and that story that you may or may not have just heard in this podcast. Yeah, and this is one of the things about desktop computers that I feel like sleep-wake battles can be won because the environment that they exist in is controlled in some way. It's not constantly on the go, connecting to weird networks and having all sorts of weird peripherals and docking things. It's sitting in one place with one set of stuff connected to it. It is a winnable war, but the variety of things that think they need to wake or half wake up your Mac has grown over time, and now I feel like it's just barely manageable.
We are sponsored this week by Mac Weldon, better than whatever you're wearing right now. Mac Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. It will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants, and more that you will ever wear. So they were known for their line of silver underwear and shirts. These are naturally antimicrobial because they actually have silver fiber woven through them. And what this means is that they eliminate odor. So like I wear these silver t-shirts all summer long and whenever I work out because it's great because you basically can't stink in them. Like I don't know how it works, but it does. And the underwear I wear every day, that's been my go-to underwear for years now. And again, the silver t-shirts, amazing for summertime and for working out. And then they also have a full line of other products as well. So I also, when I work out, I wear their sweatpants or sweatshorts. Every day I'm wearing their underwear. I'm usually wearing some of their socks too. And I'm almost always wearing one of their shirts. They have amazing Pima cotton t-shirts, long sleeve and short sleeves. I love, in the winter, I love their warm knit long sleeve shirts, like a waffle knit shirt. Love those. Very high quality, very soft, you know, all this stuff fits really well. And they have a whole line of other stuff to see. You got to see Mac Weldon stuff. It's really top quality. And I would say especially focus on the underwear and the shirts. I think that's what they really do best. So see for yourself at MacWeldon, MacWeldon.com. And you can get 20% off your first order with promo code ATP podcast. And I got to say, you really got to check this stuff out. It's really good. I love Mac Weldon stuff. I'm wearing it every day. They want you to be comfortable. So if you want to try a pair of underwear, if you don't like it, you can keep it and they'll refund you, no questions asked. Pretty cool. Once again, MacWeldon.com. For 20% off your first order, use promo code ATP podcast. MacWeldon.com, promo code ATP podcast. Thank you so much to Mac Weldon for sponsoring our show.
Tell me about your Finder toolbar battles.
That's that toolbar that kept popping up in the Finder that I would dismiss and it would reveal itself again. As I look at the Finder windows in the background now, both of them have the toolbar visible, despite me hiding the toolbar in both of those windows at least five times today. They're back. The theory on this, and this was my theory as well, but I didn't know how to test it and didn't know how to fix it, was that various third-party apps that can add toolbar buttons to the Finder toolbar could be causing this to happen. One of those apps is Dropbox, which I believe, let me go to customize toolbar and see if I can see it here. Yeah, there's a Dropbox item in customize toolbar. I don't have that item in my actual toolbar, but it's in the customize sheet. And I think something about the interaction between like whatever that plugin is lurking inside Dropbox and the Finder is causing Dropbox to do something that triggers the Finder to show the toolbar in all the open windows. I can't really uninstall Dropbox because I want to use Dropbox.
Oh, you can. I've done it. I'm Dropbox free. It's in terms of client app, anyway.
Yeah, then you got to use the web interface.
Are you using like Transmit or the web interface?
Web interface. And the only time I ever really use it is to send you or Mike files.
Yeah, huh. You've got that thing going on your Synology, but I'm not ready to do that. I use Dropbox not just for podcast stuff, but for personal stuff as well.
Yeah, that's what the Synology thing is for.
Yeah, no, not attractive. But I would like to find a way to disable the Finder integration. That used to be an option in many versions of Dropbox ago. There was a checkbox that says, do you want Finder integration? I think that also applied to the little badges, but now there's an official Apple-supported API for the badging, so there's no more checkbox because it's not a hack anymore. I think the toolbar thing is also not a hack. It's also an official API, so this may be some kind of Catalina bug. But anyway, once again, asking for help. If anybody knows, A, if it actually is Dropbox, I suppose I could uninstall it and find out, so I should just do the experiment myself. But if it is Dropbox causing my toolbar to appear, and B, how I can stop Dropbox from insisting on putting that toolbar button there that I'm never going to put in my toolbars, because I don't like toolbars.
Oh, John. All right, Marco, you had an interesting post just a couple days ago about pro mode and low power mode. Would you care to talk to us about that?
I love that John and I now both blog so infrequently. And Casey, I think you're getting there. we blog so infrequently that every time we post a blog post is worthy of discussion on the show.
This topic was in the notes before you blogged about it, because I thought it was hilarious that there was a rumor that the thing that you've always wanted, low power mode, that the rumor was that Apple was doing the opposite. Oh, you want low power mode? How about high power mode? What do you think of that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there was this rumor from 9 to 5 a few days ago about that in a Catalina beta, there were some string references found that suggest that Apple is working on something called possibly pro mode, which would be a way to temporarily enable higher performance. It would kind of suggest that it might have to do with like raising the fan speeds to basically increase the thermal output. And so presumably, like, you know, because modern laptops and computers, like modern processors, are limited with a certain thermal limit. And if you apply more cooling to them, they can usually get more performance, or at least longer sustained peak performance, before having to throttle the speeds closer down to the base clock speed. Like modern Intel Turbo Boost basically lets the CPUs burst way above the advertised clock speed much of the time that they're in use. And in fact, the advertised clock speed, like under normal operation, that all that is the minimum that they're guaranteed to be able to sustain under indefinite load. But a lot of times, even under a constant load, modern processors can sustain way above their base clock. They can sustain way, way above it for a really short time. And so if you apply more cooling, then they can sustain higher performance levels for longer times during busy workloads. And so that's what I assume Pro Mode would be doing. And that's a frequent demand, especially from video editing crowd for MacBook Pros. That's a very, very common request of like YouTubers or other video producers who are using MacBook Pros out in the field. They want to render stuff as quickly as possible, and there are times when they don't care about fan noise. They just need something to be done quickly. And so, you know, that would ideally benefit that crowd. But what I want is indeed the opposite. I want what I've been running on my laptop for a while now. I want a first-party solution. On my laptop, I've been running Turbo Boost Switcher Pro for, I don't know, like 4 years now? It's been a while now that I've been running this. And what I love about it is that it lets you disable Turbo Boost completely. And you can also automatically disable it based on whether you're on battery or not. So you could like automatically disable it when you're running on battery, and then when you're plugged in, it automatically gets enabled. I've actually usually just kept it disabled all the time, and then if I really need high performance, I go to the menu bar and toggle it, and then toggle it back when I'm done. But that's becoming less and less common that I actually need that higher performance. And the rest of the time, it may seem weird that I am buying a processor that's capable of significantly higher performance than what I ended up limiting it to. But it's actually really, really nice when performance is not your highest priority to have a laptop that is much more pleasant to use in other ways. So when you disable Turbo Boost, you lose a lot of your single thread performance. It could be up to half of your single threaded performance. Multi-core performance gets reduced a lot less, because when you're using all the cores, Turbo Boost can't boost as high anyway. So using all the cores with Turbo Boost disabled, you're looking at maybe losing about a third of your performance, depending on the processor you have and how many cores, etc. But anyway, multi-core is not affected as much as single core. But what's great about this is that the laptop, when not using Turbo Boost, runs significantly cooler, because the maximum wattage is significantly capped, way lower. You can look at my blog post for all the actual numbers here, but it runs way cooler. And that also means that the fans almost never spin up. It's almost impossible to have the fans spin up when Turbo Boost is disabled. In fact, I heard from a lot of people who like playing games this way because it keeps the fans from just going crazy when they're gaming. Windows has a control that I think does this. There is like a slider in Windows that is like performance or battery life. And I don't know what that's adjusting, but people pointed it out as a thing that this, in response to this. But anyway, so when you run disabled, so it runs way cooler, it runs way quieter, and you get way more battery life. So you are giving up a good amount of performance, but a lot of times that's not noticeable. Like most of the time I run my laptops this way and it's fine. You know, most of the work I'm doing on a laptop is casual work like, you know, email, web, social stuff with occasional bursts of Xcode productivity. And when I'm doing that, like I can get through a whole cross-country flight using Xcode and not worry about the battery because it actually will last the entire flight pushing it with Xcode without a problem when Turbo Boost is disabled. So it's a wonderful way to have a laptop. And the reason I asked for it now is, you know, not only is there a chance that Apple's listening and therefore, you know, like I figure like, hey, while you're in there, while you're making an option for Pro Mode, this would be a perfect like other end of that slider. Give us low power mode. iOS has low power mode. People use it all the time. It's a great idea because, you know, the point I'm in making the post is like all these trade-offs of like power and heat versus performance and battery life, Apple chooses one balance of those trade-offs for each product generally, and it's fixed in stone forever. And sometimes I want peak performance. Sometimes I don't care about battery life. But sometimes I want the laptop to run cool and not burn my legs and not make my hands sweaty. And I don't want to hear the fan spinning up constantly. Or I need the battery to last for a whole cross-country flight because the power outlet in my seat is broken. Like, there are times when I want a different balance. And normally, Apple does not let us control that balance of performance versus everything else. iOS's low power mode is one of the only times they've ever given us a control over that, that we can say on iOS, you know what, right now, I care more about longest battery life possible than everything being exactly fast, exactly, you know, up to date with, you know, background updates and stuff like that. Like, they give us that control. And there's lots of software stuff you can do as well, which they do in iOS low power mode. You know, stuff like on the Mac, you know, you can disable photos indexing, you can disable Spotlight, you can disable software updates, iTunes downloads, like a whole bunch of stuff that Macs do automatically in the background, even when they're on battery. You can, you know, if a proper low power mode could actually turn all those things off. In addition to modifying Turbo Boost or CPU thermal limits. Anyway, so on iOS, we have this one switch that we have low power mode. And that's great. We need that sometimes. People seem to like it. It seems to be a great success. And I think there's no real major downside to it there. That obviously, one fixed balance of performance versus other factors doesn't fit everybody all the time. So it's nice to have a control. So on the Mac, if they're going to add a control in the other direction, like making it, you know, Pro Mode, this is the perfect time to also add this one, add low power mode. It seems like they were making it work in a similar way where, like, you can't really leave it that way all the time easily. You'd have to, like, turn it on and then it automatically turns itself off tomorrow or something like that. Like, that's fine. I could deal with that. And the reason that I'm caring about this now is because Turbo Boost Switcher Pro is probably going to stop working later this year with whatever the next version of Mac OS is, because it shows this warning on Catalina of like, this developer needs to update this because it won't work with a future version of this of Mac OS, which of course means, you know, probably next year's or this year's version. So I'm concerned that this utility that I've been using to approximate low power mode that I like the effect a lot is probably going to stop working in about a year. That's why I'm hoping Apple will add this, because a proper low power mode on Mac OS has all the same benefits that it does on the iPhone. Also, apparently, I haven't verified this, but people have told me that it's not even on the iPad yet, and that I think also would be a good addition. Like, we have batteries on all these devices. Pretty much everything that does not plug into the wall should probably have a low power mode.
I have nothing to add other than to say I completely agree with you. And, you know, I think this is this is needed. I think low power mode is needed. And I also think, you know, the low data mode, which is also available in iOS, you know, something that you can approximate with trip mode. I think both of those are long overdue, and I really wish both of them existed, and I'm sad that neither of them do.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, there are other options if you're willing to disable system integrity protection. I'm not. That's, I think, not really an option. So so rule those right out.
And we had all those stories where when the Mac Pro came out where everyone was trying to configure the most expensive Mac Pro. If this Pro Mode feature ever does actually ship, I can't wait to see people seeing how fast they can burn the battery down from full charge by enabling Pro Mode and doing some sort of CPU intensive thing, giving it more thermal headroom to run sustained at higher frequencies for longer. Yeah, it's kind of weird that, I mean, I understand, you know, the Pro Apps team. What's the name of that team?
The Pro Workflow Group.
There you go. I mean, I'm sure they're saying exactly like you're saying, like sometimes, you know, I'm in a situation where even if I'm on battery, I want maximum power right now to get something done ASAP. I don't care if my battery is depleted by the end of it. So it'd be great if I had a mode that would remove the limits on the fan speed. Because historically, even on their laptops, Apple has favored throttling down the CPU and everything rather than running the fans at screaming speed all the time. And a lot of times if people do temperature sensing, they'd say like, it'd be great if Apple ran their fans a little bit faster and sped them up a little bit sooner because it seems like stuff's getting pretty toasty in there. And maybe it's like too toasty, but Apple's sort of in balancing that equation thinking, well, let's balance a little bit more in favor of noise. So I see how the Pro Workflow Group could say that balance is not really the right balance for us. So can you give us a mode where we crank it up? But it is really amazing that, you know, if this rumor is true, to even think that they would do this and not do low power mode, because like, is there the non-Pro Workflow Group saying everybody wants more battery life on their laptops? Like everybody wants that. It's why it's on phones. Like it is not an uncommon desire to say, boy, I wish this laptop had more battery life. Maybe the optimistic take is like, well, don't you worry about that because when the ARM laptops come, you're going to have more battery life than you know what to do with. But that doesn't really make much sense because the phones are ARM and they have low power mode. So I really hope low power mode comes out, is a higher priority than this, the opposite of low power mode. Like it seems like the priority should be low power mode first. And then, kind of like the Mac Pro, for those weird pro people, yeah, okay, the, you know, they, I love how they call it pro mode in the strings, by the way. Like, they can't call it, like, battery sucking mode or drain your battery mode.
By the way, too, like there's also a problem of, like, all the modern high-end, like, large laptops, like the 15-inch and the 16-inch, when you run them at full blast, they actually draw more power than their wall adapters can supply, and so they actually will slowly deplete their own batteries even when plugged in. So I'm not sure you would want a pro mode that would make that even faster, like, because all that would do would be suck more power, and again it wouldn't be able to keep up from its own wall wart, and so you would have the situation where you would be draining your internal battery faster. Faster. I mean, maybe again, like maybe you want that, but I think my concern with this, as you were just kind of alluding to, is it has seemed on a number of occasions recently that the Pro Workflow Group that Apple seems to be designing their Pro products for these days might not be as diverse as it needs to be. We, you know, we talked about this a few weeks ago that like it certainly seems like Apple is basically designing computers for video editors. And that's great. There are a lot of video editors out there, but that's not their only customer segment. And video editors have very different needs than almost anybody else. And so I hope that their product direction reflects the needs of lots of types of customers and that they aren't only prioritizing basically what YouTubers want. Like that would be unfortunate. And I don't think they are that, you know, narrow-sighted, but certainly sometimes it seems that way, and you know, some of the directions, some of the products do seem that way, but this would be an area where, like, I hope that John's right. I hope they have heard not just from video editors who say, please let me crank this laptop even faster sometimes and burn my battery even faster. But also from literally everybody else who would be like, hey, you know what? Most of the time I would like more battery life, please. And maybe not have it be so hot and loud.
Yeah, I feel like this constituency of pro users was neglected for so long that they did the right thing and made this pro workflow team to get their own sort of in-house microcosm of that constituency to find out how they can make things better for them. And I don't think it's just video editors. Like, if you just look at the Mac Pro thing, they had audio editors with a big soundtrack, and they have photographers, and they have 3D artists, right? But it's basically all of the types of applications that really can use all the power available if you just give them more of it. Despite that, you know, as we've quoted many times, and they say in their keynotes that the developers are their number one pro customer, but developers are not represented well, if at all, by the pro workflow team, it seems. But the other side of that is like, yeah, so I think of the pro workflow team as like lobbyists. I want them lobbying for the wild stuff that they need, right? But there needs to be like, the reason you needed to make that is because that's a constituency that you weren't paying attention to. So form this group. Presumably you were paying attention to everybody else before that. But now it seems like you have this vocal, powerful group within the company lobbying for exactly what they're supposed to be lobbying for, their needs. And whatever everybody else's needs are, either like maybe the company thinks, oh, we don't need any sort of in-house constituency for that because that's just everybody else and that's just us, that's just our product managers, we know what we need to do. But it seems like, you know, the voice of the customer, like the non-pro customer, isn't, there's a disconnect between I think what sort of the mainstream non-pro Mac customer in particular wants out of Apple's products and what they're providing, from everything from low power mode to number of ports and convenience to battery life and, you know, all that stuff.
Price.
Yeah, price, another good one. Whereas on the phone, I think the non-pro constituency is very well represented. They made the phones bigger and thicker and have more battery life and actually made them cheaper. Like, if you look at the recent trend in iPhones, it's so clear that the sort of non-pro regular person constituency has been getting things that they like. And the things that, you know, we wanted many years ago and they're delivering on now. So I don't think that's a problem in the phones, but when it comes to the Mac, you know, I'm happy that they're catering to the pro things and making this crazy computer that I'm sitting in front of, but it's clear that the rest of the Mac line could use a little bit more. Like, I don't think you need to make a non-pro workflow team. I think that should be just a function of the whole rest of the product org, but I think there's still a disconnect there. I think they need to have a meeting of the minds with the mass of their regular non-pro customers to get on the same page about what they want. Like, considering looking at the 16-inch, but really that's a pro product as well. And yes, it does have a bigger battery, but mostly for the needs of pros. And speaking of that, of draining the battery even when on power, does the 16-inch come with a higher wattage power brick than the 15-inch?
Yes. It went from 87 to 95, I believe, 96.
And can it still outrun that? You're saying that if you take the 16-inch and you crank it without any special tweaks, you can outrun that power adapter?
I haven't heard specifically on the 16-inch whether it still does that. I know the 15-inches before it, all the recent ones, could do that indeed. You have to, I believe, stress the CPU and the GPU, which is pretty easy to do if you're doing something like a video encode.
Yeah. So anyway, I think we still need, we don't need a round table and we don't need a non-pro workflow group. But I think we do need a closer connection between the desires of the mass of non-pro customers and what Apple's non-pro Mac groups are putting out.
We are brought to you this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com/ATP and enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. Squarespace makes it so easy to make websites, you will wonder why you ever did it any other way. It's so simple, no matter what your skill level is, whether you are a total novice at website building and computers and everything like that, or whether you are a nerd like me and like many of you probably, where you know how to make your own site. You probably might even know how to code it from scratch or install your own CMS if you want to. Squarespace takes away all the complexity of that. They give you intuitive, easy-to-use tools. No coding is required. Everything is visual. What you see is what you get, drag and drop, kind of live previewing, all that stuff. And it's so easy to make a website that looks not only great, but that looks like your own. You can customize all the fonts and colors and layouts. You can pick which content goes where, what the structure and layout of your site are. And all of this is in one place. Everything's in under one roof. You can even do domain registration there if you want to. And you can, of course, have logo designs and storefronts and podcast hosting and blog hosting and content pages and galleries and all sorts of wonderful things with Squarespace. All of this is backed by amazing customer support, and you never have to worry about software upgrades or keeping your site up or anything like that. It's all taken care of. See for yourself with a free trial site at squarespace.com/ATP. When you decide to sign up, make sure to head back there, squarespace.com/ATP, and use offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Once again, squarespace.com/ATP, code ATP for 10% off your first purchase. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace.
John, you've been taking a tour of mice and keyboards and things, and you have put four different mouses in the show notes, and I'm having a problem. And if you wouldn't mind, can you explain to me how it is you can steadfastly and adamantly and petulantly refuse to have an LG monitor with a little LG logo on it, but you can have these four f***ing abominations on your desk and be okay with that?
Apple doesn't make a mouse that I like. Apple makes one mouse. I mean, in different colors, right? But that's the only mouse they make, is the little sushi thing. And it's it's really low. And I don't like a low mouse.
Yes, I understand that. But these are hideous. How can you be so upset about the LG display and look at these and be like, yeah, okay, that's fine?
I mean, in all fairness, you aren't supposed to look at your input peripherals as you're using them, whereas you are looking at your monitor.
Yeah, but still, I mean, Marco, if you haven't yet, you need to look at these links in the show notes, because, oh boy, the Microsoft one isn't bad, but it has a Windows logo on it, and every other one is pretty bad. If we're saying that the bar for bad is the LG logo on the front of the display, then these are all hideous.
No, the LG logo is the least of the Ultrafine's problems. I don't like, so what we're looking at here is three Logitechs and a Microsoft mouse. And these aren't even like the super, like, you know, lit up RGB LED kind of like super gaming mice. Like, those I think are a little bit tacky by design, and that's what that market wants, and so that's fine. But like, these are fairly pedestrian looking mice. Like, you know, the MX Master is the like bulkiest, you know, most complicated looking one, and even it has a fairly tame like design aesthetic compared to its market of mostly like gamers, sure, and PC enthusiasts. Like, this is actually a pretty tame looking option. But yeah, I don't think this is that bad. I've seen way worse mice. In fact, Tiff owns a way worse mouse that we bought to match her ridiculous gaming PC that has like, you know, RGB lights and everything.
Of course. No, the Microsoft mouse I actually think is pretty decent looking, but it has a Windows logo on it, which I thought would just absolutely infuriate the John Syracuse of 20 years ago or whatever.
You know, actually, you could sand that off, I bet, pretty easily. Like, a lot of times, like, I did that. My car has little USB ports in the center console that you can plug in for either music, or actually you can record the footage from the cameras as dash cam footage onto USB. And I got one of those little tiny, almost like flush USB drives for it, like a little Sam. And it was a Samsung one, and it had Samsung written across it. And it was such a small thing. I was like, I don't want my car to be screaming Samsung out of this little USB thing. And so when it came, I got some sandpaper out of my garage and I just gently sanded off the logo, and it was fine. And so I have a blank USB stick in my car, and it's wonderful. And this is like, we never think of that as an option. Like, you can just slightly modify some hardware that you don't maybe like, or, you know, something about it. Like, you can just grind that thing off or sand that thing off, and usually it's fairly unintrusive and everything's fine. So I feel like John could theoretically just sand off this Windows logo of this mouse and it would probably be fine.
All right, with all that said, John, tell me about all of these mice and what you do and do not like from them.
Well, so here's where I'm coming from. I'm coming off of, you know, I was using a 10-year-old computer, and I think the mouse I was using was even older than that. Maybe not. Course. It was an MX, not even an MX300. I was using originally Logitech Wheel Mouse. It didn't have a product name. There was no names or anything like that. And I think it was replaced with an M300 model that was basically the same size and shape that I got off of like eBay or whatever. I wore out some part of it and eventually had to buy another replacement, but the shape of the mouse was what I wanted. It had straight sides, and it was somewhere, it was higher than the Apple mouse, but lower than some of the really big sort of palm filling giant snail mice. Right. and it had two buttons and it had a scroll wheel. And when I was looking for a replacement, I was like, well, all right, this mouse is kind of old, new computer, reconsider everything. Let me look at some new mice. I was mostly shopping based on shape, but when I started shopping around for mice, modern mice that are not like 10 years old, you know, I used the Apple one, right? And I didn't like it. And when I was shopping for new ones, I very quickly came to the conclusion that if you're shopping in sort of the high end of consumer mice, not getting into gaming mice quite yet, but just the high end of consumer mice, they are all better than Apple's mouse, like full stop. Now, I know you don't like the logos and I know you think they look weird, but here's the thing. Stuff that goes in your hand very often looks weird. Look at the TiVo remote. Look at most OXO things that you can buy, like my weird cheese grater. Look at hand tools. It's not a beauty contest. Symmetry doesn't win you anything. It's got to fit in your hand, which is not symmetrical and is lumpy and weird and has five appendages and one's coming out the side. It's not, you know, you're not going to make a perfect, you know, conical section or this beautiful solid. It's not going to be ergonomically good. So that's one thing. So yeah, they look weird and they are weird shapes, but they are shaped to fit your hand better than Apple's is shaped to fit your hand if you don't use it in exactly the way Apple wants you to use it, as sort of like a thing that is barely there beneath your hand, which is not how I use a mouse. I kind of grip it from the side with my thumb on one side and my pinky and ring finger on the other side and the two things on the top, right? Second thing is that the controls themselves, like there's lots more physical controls on these non-Apple mice. Obviously, Apple is the elegant solution of just the entire continuous surface, and it clicks down, and it's really nice, and it's a touch surface. It's a beautiful, elegant Apple solution, but it has limits. As discussed last time, you can't hold down the right mouse button and click the left mouse button because it's one big mouse button. Surprise! That's limiting in games and in weird, complicated apps. It doesn't have a scroll wheel. It has a scroll gesture, and I don't like that, as I described it, the same way with the Apple TV remote, where when I go to grab the mouse, I don't want any accidental scrolling happening because my fingers brush the touch-sensitive surface. I don't like thinking that it's a live beast, that if I pet the wrong way, something's going to happen on my screen. I like physical buttons, and that's what you'll get on most of these third-party mice, and in particular, the physical controls on the expensive third-party mice are nice. We talk about this in cars or on toasters. Knob feel, button feel. How do the controls feel? Do they feel cheap or expensive? Do they make lots of noise? You both remember the scroll wheel on my old mouse. You could hear it in lots of recordings. You know, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't spin it for you. But it was very noisy and didn't feel good and was kind of gross. We've come a long way there. So that's what I was shopping based on. And my thought process was try to find something more or less same size and shape as my other one, but that has a much nicer scroll wheel and some good buttons. And I was open to the idea of Bluetooth, and a lot of them are offered in Bluetooth, but I wasn't, you know, wedded to it. I did want, like, the idea of not having a cord, because my previous mouse was corded only, and it was kind of hard snaking that cord onto my keyboard tray. And I was like, you know what? I could just get rid of that cord and not have to worry about it at all. It would be nice if I could be wireless, but it wasn't a deal breaker. So I got the Microsoft Precision Mouse. It's also called the Surface Precision Mouse, which is Microsoft's fancy mouse. I tried it in the Microsoft store. I talked about that before. I got it in black, of course. Gotta go with the pro thing. I got the Logitech Marathon Mouse M705, which was a sort of middle-of-the-road, not super high-end Logitech mouse. And so that was my other... And I also had tried that in, like... I think I tried it in, like, a Staples or something when I was buying school supplies for the kids, and I remembered the model. So, you know, again, I highly recommend going to a store and trying these things before you, you know, buy based on a picture or whatever. I did look at the gaming mice, and I see a couple of contenders there, in particular the Logitech G305 Lightspeed. Looks like a mostly RGB less or RGB light mouse that I'm looking at because it seems like it's about the right size and shape, but I'm not going to buy it until I've gone to a store to hold it. I think Best Buy might have it, but I haven't had a chance to go to the store, so I don't have that mouse. I will put the link in the show notes anyway so you can look at it. But in particular, the gaming mice concentrate on the sensitivity of the sensor and all sorts of stuff having to do with the DPI and for gaming or whatever, and they, you know, working on lots of surfaces and not having lag. And those are all good things too. Like, even though I'm not buying it for gaming, I like the idea of that. And I can tell with it sort of like my old janky mouse as an example, good sensors, good optical sensors versus bad ones, you can tell the difference when you're using them, like in terms of what kind of resolution does it have and what kind of surfaces does it work on or whatever. And then finally, somebody from Logitech apparently listens to this program because a package came in the mail today that had a little handwritten note that said, I don't have it in front of me. It was like, hello, greetings from Logitech. We like the show. Enjoy. So someone from Logitech sent me a bunch of Logitech peripherals for free. And that's why I also have a Logitech MX Master 3 sitting right here. They also sent, bonus item, the magnetic camera thing that attaches to the top of your Pro Display XDR, and I'll talk about that a little bit later.
Oh, that's cool.
And they also sent a Logitech keyboard, but mice first. The thing I didn't think about when I bought these mice, it didn't occur to me until I got them all in my house and started using them, but I'm telling people listening now so they think about it as well, or obviously maybe no one cares. The underside of the mice. Whoever looks at the bottom, who cares what's on the bottom of the mouse, right? It's like the sensors down there, but other than that, like, there's no, you know, I'm in the store, I'm looking at them, I'm feeling the buttons, I'm feeling the wheels, I'm feeling the shape, and I'm not looking at the bottom of the mouse. I should have been looking at the bottom of the mouse.
I see the bottom of mine sometimes.
You do, sure do. And then you stab it in its belly button. But, you know, without looking, I mean, maybe you know this because you do charge it like a harpoon turtle, but without cheating and looking, what's on the bottom of your mouse? What's going on down there?
There's a switch to turn it on and off. There's a charging hole. And then there's the two long, like, rails of anti-skid material that I have to scrape all the gunk off of sometimes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know it because you're cleaning it, also because you harpooned it. But yeah, the Apple mouse has two long vertical strips that go down the sides of the mouse, two parallel lines of slippery material or whatever.
Yeah. I clean some stuff off of those. I just flipped it over.
Yeah. I should have looked at my old janky ancient Logitech mouse, because one of the things I liked about that mouse that I quickly found is how it feels sliding across my mousing surface. Mousing surface is just it's an Amazon Basics mouse pad at this point. Like, mouse pads is a whole other issue. I really need to get a bigger one, but my keyboard tray is oddly shaped, so it's a pain. I might have to buy one and cut it. But anyway, it's just like, I don't know, mouse pad material, regular mouse pad material. It's very thin. It's not like one of those thick ancient mouse pads from the 90s, right? It's very thin, but in the end, it's a rubbery thing with kind of like a fabric surface on it. That's what I like to mouse on. I'm open to other mousing surfaces, but history has shown, as I've tried many different ones, this is what I like. The way the little feet or whatever things on the bottom of your mouse slide across that surface makes a big difference in how a mouse feels. And if you've never looked down there or never made that connection, if you have a mouse that you really like or really hate, it could have something to do with how it actually interfaces with the surface you're sliding it across. My old Logitech had 4 feet. I think they're Teflon because it's like a fairly slippery looking plastic. 4 little tiny ovals of Teflon at the 4 corners of the mouse. It was a fairly normal shaped sort of rectangular mouse with a rounded back, just 4 little things. And the mouse was very light. All of that meant that it slid very easily and silently. I know Casey is rolling his eyes when I'm talking about the noise mice make. Stay with me here. The Apple one has way more contact than the 4 little points, and I think is also heavier. So we need to get Dr. Drang here with coefficients of friction and all sorts of other stuff, but like spreading the weight across a larger area is good, but having slipperier materials is also good, but being lighter weight is even better. Anyway, all this is to say, I did not look at the bottom of any of the mice I got, and I should have. So, for example, the Microsoft mouse. You look at the bottom of this sucker, instead of having some pads or rails, it has the entire perimeter of the mouse, like all like around the entire edge, sort of the outer edge, just one big, long, continuous trail that goes around the entire outer edge of the bottom of the mouse. And that is the slippery stuff. Logitech mouse has five pads, two big triangular ones at the back, two squarish ones at the front, and a fifth one that's kind of off to the side where the little thumb thingy is. The MX Master 3 has two vertical rails, not as long as the Apple one, but one on the left and one on the right, and then it has two semicircles on the front and the back. All of this makes a difference, and it factors in with the weight of the mouse as well, in how it feels and how it sounds going across the surface. The Microsoft mouse, in the beginning, I put it down on my mouse pad and I slid it, and I'm like, oh no, this is not going to work. It was hard to slide, and it made it like a noise, like a sort of like fingers scraping across fabric. And I was like, am I imagining things? I took my old mouse, I put it down, and I moved it. Total silence, and it moves really easily. Put the Microsoft mouse on it. Much harder to move and makes noise. Should have checked that, but I didn't. Logitech mouse, the Marathon, not as quiet as my old one, but quieter than the Microsoft one. But I didn't, you know, live and learn. I didn't look at that, but I still wanted to give them all a fair shot. So one thing I learned by giving them all a fair shot is there is a break-in period for a new mouse where the slippery junk on the bottom of the mouse gets slipperier. Today, in the Microsoft mouse, if I feel with my finger that little slippery rim, I think it's more slippery. I think it's been slowly been polishing it. It doesn't change the weight of the mouse, and it doesn't change how the weight is distributed on the pad, but it does change the sound and the feel. It gets slipperier. I have a feeling that my 10-year-old Logitech mouse, or even older than that, the really old janky one, probably is way slipperier now than it was when I bought it. Kind of like if you buy a car and 2 years later you get better 0-60 times. Like, you break the thing in, right? So I wasn't going to reject these mice for the tracking, but I did want to note that the most important thing I learned from this experience so far is that is a factor. Consider it and test it and look into it, and also consider that it may change over time. The other thing is, you know, getting back to the physical controls, the main reason I got this Microsoft Precision mouse is because this scroll wheel is fantastic. Now, I know scroll wheels are passe and everyone wants a touch surface, yada, yada. I'm not into touch surface. I want a wheel. This is a metal wheel that feels like an expensive knob in a car. It's got two modes. It's got the ratcheting mode and the free spinning mode. The free spinning mode, it feels like it's on a ball bearing. Smooth as glass, right? Solid, smooth, sort of a textured metal wheel. The button that switches modes has this satisfying electromechanical ka-thunk. I don't know if I can get on the microphone here. Let's see. I mean, you're probably not going to be able to hear that. It's probably, but anyway,
we heard it.
A satisfying thunk where you can feel like something electrically activating and moving into place and moving back. And when it goes into ratchet mode, the ratcheting mode feels like an expensive car knob with like the little, where you can feel like the little, I forget what they're called, the little notches.
Detents, I believe.
Yeah. There you go. But it's not noisy. So here, I'm going to scroll the scroll wheel. Like, this is like literally, you know, my fingers practically touching my microphone. I mean, you should hear nothing.
Nope.
Yeah, nothing.
Total silence, which is amazing. You know, my old mouse, you could hear it I'd scroll it and you could hear it in the next room. But you can still feel the little notches, right? It's not the freewheeling scroll wheel thingy like the Logitech thing that I'll get to in a second, where it's like spins and you can just give it a spin and like a roulette wheel, it'll just spin and spin and spin and then you stop it with your finger. The Microsoft mouse does not do that. It has smooth and ratcheted, but in smooth mode, it's totally smooth. There's nothing impeding the movement, but it does not freewheel spin like it's damped, right? So if you flick it, as soon as your finger leaves the wheel, it will stop moving, right? So that's the Microsoft mouse. Shape-wise, it has the little thumb rest flange, but it has a very small thumb rest flange. You know what I'm talking about? Like on the bottom of the mouse, there's a thing that sticks out of the side for your thumb to go on. Not really a fan of that thing. I'd just as soon do without it, but I bought the Microsoft one because I'm like, look, if I'm going to have a thumb thing, let's get a really tiny thumb thing. I've mostly gotten used to it. It still bothers me a little bit, but not too much. This mouse has flat sides. The buttons are really solid. The side buttons, which I mostly hate and will never use, are very thin and out of the way, and they don't touch any part of my hand when I'm using the mouse, which is nice. I do kind of appreciate having them there. I can imagine using them. It has three side buttons instead of just two, which is nice. And the mouse wheel clicks in for the third button. The other thing that I learned from buying all these mice, and I learned with the Microsoft mouse first, is that Bluetooth is garbage. Oh, I don't like God. Bluetooth.
Here we go.
Why? Like, what? How is it actually noticeable?
Maybe it's my environment. Maybe it's because my tower computer has bad antennas and is far away. But the Bluetooth signal from this Microsoft mouse to my computer is not good enough to get smooth mouse movement all the time. And it's not some Catalina thing where it's freaking out. Like, it's fine. Most people wouldn't notice, but I can totally notice that the tracking is not great. Occasionally you get a little hitch. I don't know what the problem is. But I think it's Bluetooth. Or maybe it's this mouse, because I tried the mouse on my wife's computer too, which presumably the Bluetooth is closer there. It's like a 5K iMac, and then we're right in front of it with the mouse. And it was mostly fine, but it had a couple of hiccups. She rejected it the first time it had any kind of tracking hiccup. She's like, get this thing off my computer. And I don't blame her. Like, when you move the mouse, it should move the cursor in a direct one-to-one connection, and there should be no hitches, especially if your computer is idle. And she's not on Catalina, right? And she has had other Bluetooth peripherals, that aren't pointing devices like Bluetooth keyboards and stuff. Like, you know, the only reason I'm rejecting it out of hand is because I'm coming from a world with wired mice, which never have this problem at all, right? And also because of Logitech. So the Microsoft mouse, well, I'll get to the Logitech stuff in a second, but the Microsoft mouse in Bluetooth mode, unacceptable. Luckily, the Microsoft mouse comes with a very, very long, thin USB cable that you can connect to the front of it, and it becomes a wired mouse. And in wired mode, no problems. No hitches, no nothing. On the other hand, now you have a wire attached. It's an interesting, the fact that you can just plug and unplug it at the mouse, at the point of the mouse, and it's such a thin, long cable is kind of nice, because when I have my work laptop here, and I'm working, but I have my computer sort of behind it, I can use the mouse with both. I use it in wired mode with my Mac, and then when I unplug it, it's paired with the laptop, you know what I mean? On the same keyboard tray. Again, more Logitech stuff on that in a moment, but I like that arrangement. So for a while, the Microsoft mouse was my winner using it in wired mode because the ergonomics were right. I love the scroll wheel. The buttons were great. The shape was pretty good. The thumb flange wasn't too low. I was breaking in the little pads in the bottom, and I didn't have to deal with Bluetooth because it was plugged in. Logitech. Everyone knows Logitech has their own thing going on with, before Bluetooth, they had their own little wireless RF dongle. You'd stick it into a USB port and the mouse would communicate with it. And as far as the computer was concerned, it's like there was a USB mouse connected to it, but really there was no wire there. You know, it's like USB, but there's no cat. Come on, YouTube won't get that. That's like a literary reference, not literary, a literary historical. It's a highbrow reference, much higher brow than like 80s movies.
Oh my goodness.
Our listeners will get it. You can look it up after. Anyway, my wife has been using a wireless Logitech mouse with her computers since the 2011 MacBook Air. I haven't, I've been using wired peripherals, but I've seen people use them at work. Let me tell you, Logitech, again, disclaimer, they sent me a bunch of free stuff. So take this with a grain of salt if you want, but this is my opinion before they sent me a bunch of free stuff as well. That stupid little RF dongle is rock solid.
Yeah, it always has been. That's like one of the great reasons to use Logitech stuff is that those little RF dongles are way better than Bluetooth. And usually they also usually lead to much longer battery life in the mice, and it's just like everything about them is better.
Yeah, it is fantastic. You would think, isn't this janky? Isn't this like a non-Apple, non-elegant solution? Shouldn't everything just be Bluetooth? It's built into your computer. The answer is no. That Logitech RF thing is amazing. Now, setting aside the USB 3.0 interference crap, which is not Logitech's fault, it's probably Intel's fault, right? Setting that aside, that stupid little dongle, which now is microscopic, it is, if you A-B tested me with a wired connection versus that RF thing, I'm not sure I could tell the difference. It does not stutter. It does not switch. The battery lasts for like 7 years in your mouse. It is unbelievable. So, and in general, I tend to like Logitech mice. I mean, again, I've been using that older Logitech mouse for 10 years, right? So I'm predisposed to like Logitech. The tracking was just unbelievable, right? The Marathon doesn't have a USB connection, so I have to use the wireless one. But like, you know, I was like, well, Logitech has this down. They've cornered this market. Until Bluetooth can match it, I should just not even consider Bluetooth mice. The Marathon mouse, specifically the mouse wheel, not as nice as the Microsoft one. It's one that does scrolling sideways by tilting the mouse. Do you remember that mechanism?
Mm-hmm.
It's not ideal. Ew. It has a ratcheting mode and it has a smooth mode. The smooth mode is very smooth. The ratcheting mode is ratcheting, but it's also a rattle here. It's more fully. Listen to this. When you shake your mouse, you shouldn't hear anything. You shake this mouse, you hear something. It's because there's a lot of play in the mouse wheel. The buttons are okay. The shape is pretty good, but it's got a little bit of an overhang where your thumb goes instead of having straight sides like the Microsoft one. It's got two side buttons instead of three. The feet and the sort of the scrolling action, or the, I don't know what you call it, the mousing action is better than having the perimeter, but it is also breaking in. I think these pads are not even Teflon. They're like weirdly textured. So I think they're intentionally slowing it down a little bit, and I could do with it being a little bit more slick. But in the competition between these two mice, which are the first two that I bought, the Microsoft one was winning, but I was using it wired. Finally, the Logitech Scent, the MX Master 3, which I know as the mouse that destroyed Mike Hurley's hands through RSI. that is the reputation that what do you know about this mouse? Mark Curley had one and it hurt his hand. That's what I know about this mouse. And, you know, I know that it's been around for a while. Lots of people have it, you know, and so on and so forth. It's their fancy mouse. This has the thumb shelf to end all thumb shelves. I don't know what they are expecting you to put on there. I don't know how big people's thumbs are. I knew there's a button in the thumb shelf. A couple of the Logitech mice have like this button down there. I don't need a button in the thumb shelf. This thumb shelf is so big I could fit like three fingers on it. I don't like. I was intentionally avoiding this mouse and not getting it because I'm like, all right, I can handle a thumb shelf, but not that thumb shelf, right? As it turns out, the gigantic thumb shelf is a problem, but it's not. It was not the first problem I noticed. The first one I noticed is that the thumb shelf and the whole wraparound thing of this mouse is sort of textured with like a scalloped kind of corduroy type texture that I do not find particularly pleasing.
Can you only pet it in one direction?
You can't. I mean, it is kind of unidirectional. I don't know. Like they're kind of contour lines, like on the bottom of a blue whale, only on a mouse. I would prefer it if it was smooth.
I love the idea that you think people will have seen a blue whale.
Everyone knows what the underside of a blue whale looks like. When you see it in the encyclopedia with the big, like, vertical, like, corduroy stripes, right?
I would guess that listeners of this show might actually be more likely to know what an MX Master looks like than the underside of a certain type of whale.
Some people know what animals look like, Marco. Anyway, the MX Master is a very high mouse. It is the highest one. It is also the one that rotates your hand most towards the hand shake grip. It's not a vertical mouse. Like a lot of people make vertical mice that you put your hand on it in the same position as you would perform a handshake, like vertically. That is better ergonomically than turning your wrists inward. That's why keyboards are tilted, and that's why, you know, split keyboards, yada yada, right? So ergonomically, I'm thinking this is probably better for hand position than these other mice. I do understand why Mike might have had RSI issues, because the MX Master has, like, it's got a scroll wheel, but it also has a horizontal scroll wheel by your thumb. And it has two buttons by your thumb, and then it's got the main two buttons, and then it's got the gesture button down underneath your thumb. It's got a lot of controls, and if you try to work all the controls, it's a little bit, you have to be a little bit of a contortionist. You can mostly ignore the other controls if you don't want them, because it's so high, like the wheel is up above your hand. Anyway, the scrolling action on this, better than the cheaper Logitech mice in terms of the smoothness of the pads moving across them. Not as smooth as my old mouse, but definitely smoother than the Microsoft mouse. Again, I'm talking about physically scraping across the thing. The scroll wheel on this one, this is Logitech's fancy scroll wheel. It is metal. It is solid. It has the same sort of silent ratcheting feel as the Microsoft one. Maybe a little bit less stiff. I still think Microsoft has the best scroll wheel on the market right now that I've tried. But this one has the thing where if you spin it real fast, it will auto switch from ratcheting mode to free spinning. and this has the momentum where it will freely spin and keep spinning until you stop it. In my experimentation, because the other Logic Mouse also has that mode, I found that I don't really like the free spinning mode where you just give it a spin and then stop it when you hit where you want. That's not the way I like to work. I tried to get used to it over the course of a couple weeks and I couldn't, but I am still playing with the Logitech one where it's mostly ratcheting, but you don't have to switch modes itself. It'll auto switch the modes for you. I'm using it wireless. I'm using it with the little wireless dongle in recent decades. I don't know how long ago this happened, probably 5 years ago or whatever. Logitech had changed their little RF dongle to be what they call a unifying receiver, where you just need one of those little turdy dongles and you use it with any number. I don't know, there's probably a limit, but any number of Logitech peripherals. And this is good because if you have, like, you know, multiple mice and keyboards or whatever, you could pair them all with that dongle. You don't need five USB ports, right? And they come with some software that to manage that, which I actually installed. But you're like, oh my god, you bought hardware and you installed drivers for it? Don't do that. Like, if it works without the drivers, by all means, do not install any third-party stuff. And I know, I hear where you're coming from there. That's usually my ethos. But, well, first of all, I disobeyed that by buying Steer Mouse for the first two mice to mess with the tracking adjustments. I don't know if you remember the software. It's like a USB mouse setting Swiss Army knife where you can assign all the buttons on basically any mouse. You can control the cursor by adjusting the acceleration to like four decimal points and sensitivity, and there's like window snapping, and you can switch through different settings for different mice and save them, and you could let the system control the mouse or let the, you know, it's very flexible piece of software. I highly recommend Steer Mouse, despite the fact that their little mouse icon is horrendously ugly and they should have someone draw a new one for them because it's uglier than all the mice that are on my desk. It looks like... it looks like a tampon. Let's just say it. It looks like a plastic applicator tampon. Please, Steer Mouse, change your icon to something else. So I already installed that, and I found it extremely valuable for trying to adjust the tracking to make them all feel good, like to make them all feel like the Apple mouse, basically, in terms of acceleration curves and everything. And surprisingly, they don't out of the box if you just use them without any drivers. But for the MX Master, I installed the crazy Logitech thing.
That is a very wide tampon.
Yeah, well, you know, some people, yeah. The Logitech software is called Logitech Options. It has a terribly ugly icon, but the interface is actually pretty nice. I put a screenshot of it into our Slack thing. It shows you nice photos of the devices that are hooked up to your computer, and you click through to them, and it lets you customize the buttons and lets you, you know, change the scrolling stuff. You can change the sensitivity at which the wheel switches from ratcheting to freewheeling. There's a whole bunch of other options. You have different things for scrolling and pointer speed and different settings for the, you know, like everything you would imagine. As far as I can tell, it has not destroyed my computer. The app seems to be well behaved. And the tracking on this mouse, again, I can definitely say with this MX Master, I could not tell the difference between this and a USB connected mouse. There's no way I could tell. It is buttery smooth. Perfect precision and control. No matter how fast they move the thing, it is amazing. Shape wise, I thought I was going to hate this thing because of the giant thumb shelf and because of how high it is. But in practice, I'm kind of getting used to it. Here is the one big downside, and this has a little bit to do with my setup here: the gigantic thumb shelf. There is a little pad again, the bottom of the mouse. One of the slippery pads is under the thumb shelf at the edge. Because my mouse pad is not quite big enough, occasionally I will mouse to the left edge of my mouse pad when I'm traversing my gigantic monitor. And the mouse, as far as I'm concerned, has not left the edge of the mouse pad, right? Because my thumb is still well within the perimeter of the mouse pad. But the stupid shelf sticks out so far that the shelf has left the edge of the mouse pad and now has fallen down like a millimeter. And when I try to move it back, the little pad thing on the thumb shelf catches on the edge of the mouse pad. Which is terrible, which is another reason that A, this thumb shelf shouldn't be as big, but B, I need a bigger mouse pad so that I can make the mouse pad extend all the way so it hits the edge of my keyboard. And that way, will never be able to get the thumb shelf off the edge, because before that happens, the thumb shelf will hit my keyboard. So yeah, in this competition right now, I'm using the MX Master just because it is the newest one, and I want to give it a fair shake of using it for, you know, a week or so. To see, my previous champion was the Microsoft mouse. Again, if you don't know what a good knob on a toaster feels like, or a good knob on a car feels like, or a good scroll wheel feels like, go to a Microsoft store and feel the scroll wheel on the Microsoft Precision Mouse. Whoever made this scroll wheel deserves a raise. As for the Windows logo, it's the new Windows logo, which everybody knows, but if you don't think about, the new Windows logo is literally a square with a vertical line and a horizontal line going through the center of it. That's the logo. It is so generic. It is so generic that it's very easy for me to look at this and absolutely not recognize that as a Windows logo. It's also gray on a black mouse, right?
Oh, but you know what it really is.
Well, here's what I'm going to say. This is a good peripheral. This is a good mouse. We talked about this before. Microsoft has made and continues to make good peripherals. This mouse is better than Apple's mouse. Full stop. Unless you like very low mice, right? If you like very low mice, this mouse sucks because it's higher than the Apple mouse, right? But it's just plain better. It is ergonomically better. It is easier to hold. It has more affordances. The controls on it, like the click, feels higher quality than Apple's click on its giant mouse. It's a good product. Like, I don't, you know, Microsoft makes a good product. They deserve to have their logo on this mouse. The MX Master is a bit of an abomination. It has a bunch of crap sticking out of it that I'm never going to use. But the scrolling on it is great. And the final thing is, Logitech has, as part of this weird software that I installed that I hope I'm not going to regret, they have a thing where you can use multiple computers with the same set of peripherals and transparently switch between them. So you can bring the mouse to one edge of your screen, the mouse cursor, and it will leap onto another computer's screen. No KVM switching, no anything, like literally the same mouse on two computers. Which you would think that's great, because sometimes you've got your work laptop and your home thing and you're trying to do both at once and you don't have two mice and I don't want to use the trackpad. But it does that magic using networking. And I think when my laptop's on the VPN, that whole system won't work. So I'm probably not going to bother trying with it. The keyboard they sent, this is going to probably drive Marco up a wall, but this is definitely a thing. There's too much key travel.
Oh, my word.
There's too much key travel. I mean, you know, I've been using the Apple aluminum keyboard. I used the Apple Extended 2 for years, and then I had RSI issues, and I found that the Apple USB keyboards with the very short, light travel, like the original Apple aluminum extended keyboard, I found that better for my RSI. And since then, I've been a big proponent of these Apple monitors that don't take a lot of pressure or distance to press the keys, because that's better for my RSI. With the Apple Extended 2, I was, hitting the keys too hard, and it really exacerbated things, right? I'm now on the keyboard that came with my Mac Pro, which is the Magic Key Switches, which I love. I like these key switches. These are my favorite desktop key switches I've ever used in my post-RSI era. I tried the Logitech keyboard, and those keys have so much travel. I felt like I was going on a journey every time I pressed the key. Now, they don't have as much travel as the Apple Extended 2. Like, I'm not saying it's like that, but compared to the Magic Key, I just felt like I was putting in so much work. I don't have the kind of time to wait for these keys to go down. And the keycaps are oddly shaped. Other than that, the keyboard is, and also the keyboard has like a kickstand on the back where it's like cranked up. And that's exactly the wrong thing for a keyboard to do. It should be level or tilted away from you even. But it weighs a ton. It is made of metal. But most importantly for the multi-computer scenario, that keyboard has three dedicated buttons where you can hit those buttons and it will cycle through three different computers. Again, using this Logitech, software and these unified receivers or whatever. So if you go all Logitech, and if you do not have one of your computers on a VPN, you can use a single keyboard and a single mouse to interact with three of them at the same time by pressing buttons on the keyboard to switch what the input is, and by just moving the mouse between the screens, which is not a thing that I'm particularly interested in, but I'm glad that feature exists. And I have to say, so far, using their software that they installed that hopefully is not destroying my computer, it's fairly straightforward to use, and other than the ugly icon, it seems kind of nice. I don't know. I mean, maybe next week I'll come and say the Logitech software has destroyed my computer. But so far, I think it's actually pretty nice. And then finally, the camera, because my six umpteen bajillion dollar Pro Display XDR does not come with a camera of any kind, but Logitech will sell you one for, what is it, like $200 or something? It's expensive. Anyway, it's a quote-unquote webcam. I think it's 4K. I had a few curiosities about this. One, how do you have to connect it to your computer so that it works? And two, how is the interface between, like, how does it physically connect? You know, I know they said it's like magnetic or whatever, but how does that work? Like, is it just, you know, because the monitor case, I'm assuming, is aluminum, which is not particularly magnetic. How does it actually connect? Well, so the physical connection, as far as I can tell, and I really don't want anyone to tell me otherwise, because then I'll have to take out a tape measure. It's like on the smart cover thing on iPads, where like it kind of like there's magnets in the device and also magnets in the cover, and they line up with each other. So it's kind of hard to get a smart cover on the wrong way. Like it just snaps in, and you don't have to worry like, oh, is it off? Is it shifted? It goes into position, right? So you bring this camera near the top of this monitor, and it just chunk magnetizes right to a spot that I assume is dead center in the monitor, which I find extremely pleasing. And please don't tell me if it's not true. Because I think that's the only place it goes on. I don't think you can put it on the left or on the right. I think it only magnetizes in the middle. Second thing is connecting it with the cable. It's USB-C. There's a little USB-C port in the back of the camera. And you could connect that all sorts of places. I could run a cable from the camera to the back of my computer, to the top of my computer, but also to the USB-C ports that are on the back of my monitor. Ah, but with the base video card, the Radeon 580X, those USB ports are only USB 2.0 because all the high-speed lanes in the connection between the computer and the monitor are being taken up by the non-display stream compressed video. So all I've got left is USB 2.0. Is that sufficient for 4K video? The camera comes with a tiny little cable that connects directly from the camera and is just long enough to reach any one of the three USB-C ports, which I super appreciate because cable management is an issue. And this is a tiny, beautiful, purpose-built cable. One is a right angle. The connector is a right angle for going into the back of the monitor, and the other one goes in, or maybe in reverse. Anyway, it's like a perfectly sized cable. Plugged it into the back of the monitor. I think it's working. I opened FaceTime. I saw myself. I think I was in 4K. It's really hard for me to tell. The camera tilts, which is nice. The monitor is so big that I have to tilt the camera down, even though I ergonomically adjusted it so that the top of monitor is directly aligned with my eye line, right? That's where I have it lined up. Even doing that, maybe I'm just slouching all the time. I don't know. But I had to aim the camera down to get like a view of myself and not like the view of the room behind me. So it's aimed down a little bit. The only way the whole physical setup could be better, one, if the camera was smaller, because obviously it's a little bit comically large for what it's doing. I don't know what the hell is inside that thing, but it's like, come on, you can build, granted, a crappier camera, but a so much smaller one in the 5K iMac, so much so that you don't even see that it's there. Now I have this thing sitting on top of my monitor that's a little bit overwhelming. And two, everyone should see this one coming. I would like it better if the tiny little purpose-built cable that came to connect this camera to the back of my monitor was...
braided in black. Yep.
You got it. Braided in black. Make everything braided. But anyway, I will accept this merely black but not braided cable because it is the perfect length.
Oh, my word.
So, the gaming mouse I'm interested in because of the high DPI and because the shape of it is the closest to my old mouse, but I haven't tried that yet. So I've been sitting here with this computer with multiple mice. I think I've had at least three mice sitting on this desk all connected to the computer at the same time for... multiple weeks now. I'm not sure when I'm ever going to pick a winner and retire one, but right now it feels like the Microsoft mouse is probably still in the lead, but the MX Master had a few days in it and it's really nice. So I think the lesson here is that if you haven't looked at the world of third-party mice, look at it, because there's some good stuff out there. And you may be surprised to find something that, both of your reactions looking at the beginning of these things, they are homely looking. They're not like sleek or beautiful, but some of them really are good. Knob feel is a thing. Mouse feel is a thing. And in particular, non-Bluetooth connections of your mice is also a thing. Do not turn your nose up at it because it's old tech. It's old tech that works.
I will also add very briefly here, you mentioned during your keyboard segment that it would probably drive me crazy that you were saying you wanted a keyboard with less travel. I actually, just by coincidence, happened to, between last week and this week, change my keyboard temporarily. I usually use the Microsoft Sculpt ergonomic keyboard, not the Surface ergonomic, the Sculpt ergonomic. That is a, it is a split black keyboard with a gap in the middle and elevated on the front. So, it's by far my favorite ergonomic keyboard, and I've been using it for a number of years now. However, there is one fatal flaw with the Microsoft Sculpt ergonomic keyboard. After a while, it just kind of flakes out. Then you got to replace it. Like, there's no there's no coming back from it. Like, after a while, like, keystrokes will start, like, queuing up or getting missed or something, and you can change the batteries and you can move the receiver around, and it just never fixes itself. You just have to replace it. Fortunately, they're only about $60. Mine last about 2 years. So I wore out the current one I was using, went to the closet, had to get the next one, but I thought, well, now that I'm replacing it, I've gone through this, you know, this kind of self-improvement kick for the last couple of years. And one of the things that I mentioned on the show is I tried to eliminate myself from, like, being able to, from having to say, like, oh, I don't like an entire class of food. So, like, now I can eat seafood, for instance, that I used to just say, like, I don't like seafood, and that would make it hard to go to certain types of restaurants. And I hated that limitation. So I've slowly worked to, like, eliminate my limitations as much as possible. And one of the things I thought was, now that I'm in better shape than I've ever been in, you know, I have, like, regular exercise, my arms and wrists are in better condition than they've been in, maybe I don't need a split ergonomic keyboard anymore. I would love to be able to just comfortably use any keyboard again and be able to join this, like, you know, mechanical keyboard revolution that everyone's going through and everything. And I happen to have in my closet for years a Philco Magistux 2 10 keyless mechanical keyboard with the Cherry MX brown switches. I bought it years ago thinking maybe I would try it then. Tried it for about a week, started getting sore, and put it in the closet. So I thought, now that I'm between keyboards while I replace my Sculpt, let me try that again. And sure enough, the Sculpt has scissor style keys, laptop kind of travel scissor style keys. The Philco, of course, has, like, the big mechanical Cherry MX keys, so, like, you know, the big full travel. It felt weird to me to go back, because, like, I've been using scissor keys, on my desktop and my laptop full time for over a decade. And so it's been a very long time since I've used, like, full big, you know, ka-chunk style keys, and it really did feel weird to me. And I ended up putting it back, not because of the travel, although I didn't give it enough time to get used to it. I gave it less than a day, but because I kept hitting the wrong modifiers and everything, because I realized that the Sculpt has kind of ruined me for placement of what it is labeled as the Alt key, but what functionally behaves as the Command key, the key next to the spacebar that modifies your commands. It lines up its Alt key almost below the E, and most keyboards align that key below the W, or bridging between the W and the E. And so I realize I've actually kind of, like, my muscle memory of my left hand hitting Command/Alt, and all of the keys on that side, like W, E, you know, for window closing, stuff like that, it was all off. I kept, like, accidentally quitting my apps because I was hitting Q instead of W and everything. It was crazy. And so I had to switch back just because, like, that was too much of an adjustment for me. Like, that and the key travel, it just felt really weird to me. So I'm kind of ruined now. And, like, now I kind of feel like scissor keys are my full travel keyboard. And, I mean, again, really, they have been for over a decade, if I'm honest with myself. But I wonder if that will ever transition further. Like, I wonder if I will slowly get used to the lower and lower travel scissor key switches that Apple is moving towards over the years. And maybe eventually I won't care and I'll be like, yeah, bring back the butterfly. God, I hope not.
Oh, my goodness.
you'll be ready to type on glass.
Yeah, right, exactly. Is there a lower limit to, like, how, what we will get used to? I think the butterfly keyboard might have shown, like, oh yeah, okay, there is such a thing as too far.
I think Apple had a patent on a negative travel keyboard where the buttons actually bulge out at you.
Yeah, they hit you.
Did you see that one? They did have a thing where it's, like, the screen bulges so you could feel where the keys are, which is basically negative travel if they don't go in. Like, it reaches out to touch you. Anyway. Yeah, mechanical keyboards do feel, like, I used, you know, the Apple Extended 2 I used from, you know, the release of the SE30 all the way up until, I think, my blue and white G3, just that same keyboard Apple Extended to. And then I switched to USB full travel keyboards, and then I switched to the lower travel ones. But yeah, it does feel weird to go back. It feels like I said, it feels like you're going on quite a journey to get each key press. It's like, why am I? It feels like you're using your whole arm. It's like, really? And, you know, again, technology marches on. I still vastly prefer this, the whatever key switches are in this Magic Keyboard that came with my Mac Pro. I vastly prefer that to the butterfly switches. And by the way, I just got my 2017 MacBook Pro back from repair at work, and you know, I'm assuming they did a total keyboard replacement, because I think that's the only way you can repair these things, but my space bar is back. They didn't replace it with the membrane one. As far as I can tell, I think you're not even able to replace it with the membrane one because it feels the same as it did. But yeah, this, you know, I never really seriously considered a different keyboard. I really like this one that came with the Mac Pro, and the key travel has got to be like a third or a quarter of what it was on the Apple Extended 2. Maybe less. Maybe I'm underestimating it. Oh, I forgot to mention about the Logitech ridiculous software that it comes with. Because this mouse has a million different settings on it. So cool things that this thing does. It has settings for each of your devices, and you can also use per application settings, and it syncs them all to the cloud. So no matter what, you know, they have some kind of cloud service. So no matter what Mac you hook up to, or any computer, Mac or PC that you use this mouse with, it will remember your preferences for how the buttons work and how the scroll wheel works and how the tracking works, which is great. Like, not having to sync that up, that's a great use of the cloud. And the second thing is, it comes with a bunch of saved sets of, like, here, we've customized the things for this app, right? So I'm in Chrome now, and if I do the horizontal scroll wheel, it switches between tabs. I don't know what all the settings are. I didn't look at them. Like, it prompts you and says, hey, do you want to try all these settings? And I was like, you know what? Why the hell not? Like, it has ones for Photoshop. It has ones for a whole bunch of different common apps where it tries to make all the various buttons and stuff do things that are interesting and useful in those apps. Obviously, you can customize this yourself. Again, maybe why Mike got RSI. Maybe he had a Logic setup where he was doing all sorts of commands with it or whatever. But I like the idea that they do most of that work for you and sync it all through the cloud and have sort of third-party sharing of things. SteerMouse has that too, by the way. There's like, hey, here are settings that other people found useful for this particular mouse in terms of acceleration and sensitivity that works with, you know, and I would try other people's settings that are like rated with star ratings or something and see how do other people have it set up and do I like it? That is technology that's like above and beyond like what you would think of in the old days of like you connect a mouse to the computer and it is what it is. It's so much beyond that now, and I'm really proud of Logitech for, like, I expected their software to be garbage and I expected their mice to be kind of clunky, and these things feel really solid and their software seems pretty good and has useful features. I know it sounds terrible because they just sent me a bunch of free stuff, but this was my opinion before they sent me the free stuff as well. Take it as you will.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace, Linode, and Mac Weldon, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. 'Cause it was accidental. Accidental. Oh, it was accidental. Accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. 'Cause it was accidental. Accidental. Oh, it was accidental. Accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
You know, I didn't get a chance to say this in the show, but I don't understand why you don't just do what I did, which a year or two ago would have seemed like heresy. I hope I pronounced that right. But anyways.
It's pronounced hearsay.
Yeah, hearsay. It would have been hearsay. But anyways, switching to the Magic Trackpad, which I'm actually surprised.
Oh, I hate trackpads. Oh my God. You should have had them in the show. No, trackpads never.
John, no, John. A year ago, I completely agree with you. A year ago, no. I am probably more devout in my hatred a year ago of trackpads than you are. But now I'm happy with it.
I'm never switching to a trackpad. It's one of the reasons I hate laptops. I grew up with mice the way other people grew up with walking. Like, just give up walking and try like dragging your body across the ground by your teeth. No, I'm always going to walk. I am always going to use a mouse for things that are mouse-like. Oh my God, I hate trackpads. I understand why you have to have one on a laptop, because it's a laptop, but it's the only reason I ever will ever use one.
Wow.
God, I hate trackpads.
John, I'm telling you, a year ago, I would have been even more devout.
As an accessory, like how Marco uses it? Yeah, then you're like a two-handed thing. This is my swipey pad, and this is my mouse. But no, I got...
Yeah, I'm a big fan. Left-hand trackpad, right-hand mouse. Big fan.
But I got... The cursor is controlled by the mouse.